The dairy report included the first jagged elements, the crash of the Unity pumper, the death of a forest ranger who appeared to have been shotgunned by his own pacemaker. At 1:30 p.m. Mountain Time, a Utah State Police cruiser stopped at the campground where Jim Tierney and his family were staying. The troop informed him there was an emergency in his home state. What sort of emergency? That, the trooper had been told, was information obtainable strictly on a need-to-know basis. Tierney could have called Derry, but Torgerson in Cleves Mills was a guy he knew and trusted. Right now he wanted more than anything else to talk to someone he trusted. He felt a slow, sinking dread in his gut, a feeling that it had to be Maine Yankee, had to be something with the state's only nuclear plant, had to be. Only something that big could have caused this kind of extraordinary response almost a whole country away. The trooper patched him through. Torgerson was both delighted and relieved to hear Tierney's voice. At 1:37 p.m. Mountain Time, Tierney climbed into the shotgun seat of the cruiser and said, "How fast does this go?" "Sir, this vehicle will go 130 miles an hour, and I am a Mormon, sir, and I am not afraid to drive it at that speed, sir, because I am confident that I will avoid hell. Sir." "Prove it," Tierney said. At 2:03 p.m. Mountain Time, Tierney was in a Learjet with no markings but the U.S. flag on its tail. It had been waiting for him at a small private airfield near Cottonwoods, the town of which Zane Grey wrote in Riders of the Purple Sage, the book which had been Roberta Anderson's favorite as a girl, the one which had perhaps set her course forever as a writer of westerns. The pilot was in mufti. "Are you Defense Department?" Tierney asked. The pilot looked at him with expressionless dark glasses. "Shop." It was the only word he spoke before, during, or after the flight. That was how the Dallas police entered the game. 5. Haven had been nothing but a wide place in the road, dreaming its life away comfortably off the major main tourist tracks. Now it had been noticed. Now people headed there in droves. Since they knew nothing of the anomalies that were being reported in ever-increasing numbers, it was only the growing pall of smoke on the horizon which drew them, at first, like moths to candle flames. It would be almost 7 o'clock that evening before the state police, with the help of the local National Guard unit, would be able to block off all the roads to the area, the minor ones as well as the major. By morning, the fire would become the greatest forest fire in Maine history. The brisk easterly wind came up right on schedule, and once it did, there was no way the fire's running start could be overcome. The realization did not sink in all at once, but it did sink in. The fire might have burned unchecked even if the day had been dead calm. You couldn't do much about a fire you couldn't get to, and efforts to get near this one had unpleasant results. The spotter plane had crashed. A busload of National Guardsmen from Bangor ran off the road, struck a tree, and exploded when the driver's brain simply burst like a tomato loaded with a cherry bomb. All 70 weekend warriors died, but maybe only half of them in the crash. The rest died in a fruitless effort to crawl out of the poison belt. Unfortunately, the wind was blowing the wrong way, as Torgerson could have told them. The forest fire, which had begun in burning woods and crisped half of Newport before firefighters could properly go to work, but by then they were strung too thin to do much good, because the fire line was nearly 6 miles long. By 7 that evening, hundreds of people, some self-appointed firefighters, most your common garden-variety Homo rubbernecus, had poured into the area. Most promptly poured right back out again, faces white, eyes bulging, noses and ears jetting blood. Some came clutching their lost teeth in their hands like pitted pearls, and not a few of them died, not to mention the hundred or so hapless residents of eastern Newport who got a sudden dose of Haven when the wind turned brisk. Most of those died in their houses. Those who came to gawk and stayed to asphyxiate on the rotten air were found in or beside various roads, curled in fetal positions, hands clutched over their stomachs. Most, one GI later told the Washington Post, under the strict condition that he not be identified, looked like bloody human commas. Such was not the fate of Lester Moran, a textbook salesman who lived in a Boston suburb and spent most of his days on the highways of northern New England. Lester was returning from his annual late-summer selling trip to the schools in the SADs, School Administrative Districts, of Aroostook County, when he saw smoke, a lot of it, on the horizon. This was at about 4:15 p.m. Lester diverted immediately. He was in no hurry to get back, being a bachelor and having no plans for the next 2 weeks or so. But he would have diverted, even if the National Sales Conference had been slated to begin the next day with him as the principal speaker and his speech still unwritten. He couldn't have helped himself. Lester Moran was a fire freak. He had been one since earliest childhood. In spite of having spent the last 5 days on the road, in spite of a fanny that felt like a board and kidneys that felt like bricks after the constant jolting his sprung car had taken on the shitty roads of townships, so small they mostly had map coordinates for names, Lester never thought twice. His weariness fell away. His eyes glowed with that preternatural light which fire chiefs from Manhattan to Moscow know and dread, the unholy excitement of the natural-born fire freak. They are the sort of people fire chiefs will, however, put to use, if driven to the wall. 5 minutes ago, Lester Moran, who had applied to the Boston Fire Department at the age of 21 and been turned down because of the steel plate in his skull, had felt like a whipped dog. Now he felt like a man highballing on amphetamines. Now he was a man who would happily don an Indian pump, which weighed almost half as much as he did himself, and lug it on his back all night, breathing smoke the way some men breathe the perfume on the nape of a beautiful woman's neck, fighting the flames until the skin of his cheeks was cracked and blistered and his eyebrows were burned clean off. He exited the turnpike at Newport and burned up the road which led toward Haven. The plate in his head was the result of a hideous accident which had occurred when Moran was 12 and a junior high patrol boy. A car had struck him and thrown him 30 feet, where his flight had been interrupted by the obdurate brick wall of a furniture warehouse. He had been given last rites. His weeping parents had been told by the surgeon who operated on him that their son would likely die within 6 hours, or remain in a coma for several days or weeks before succumbing. Instead, the boy had been awake and asking for ice cream before the end of the day. "I think it's a miracle," the boy's sobbing mother cried. "A miracle from God." "Me too," said the surgeon who had operated on Lester Moran, and who had looked at the boy's brain through a gaping hole in the poor kid's shattered skull. Now, closing in on all that delightful smoke, Lester began to feel a little sick to his stomach, but he chalked that up to excitement and then forgot all about it. The plate in his skull was, after all, nearly twice the size of the one in Jim Gardner's. The absence of police, fire, or forestry department vehicles in the thickening murk he found both extraordinary and oddly exhilarating. Then he rounded a sharp curve and saw a bronze-colored Plymouth lying upside down in the left-hand ditch, its red dashboard flasher still pulsing. Written on the side was, "Derry, F.D." Lester parked his old Ford wagon, got out, and trotted over to the wreck. There was blood on the steering wheel and the seat and driver's side floor mat. There were droplets of blood on the windshield. All in all, quite a lot of blood. Lester stared at it, horrified, and then looked toward Haven. Dull red colored the base of the smoke now, and he realized he could actually hear the dull crackle of burning wood. It was like standing near the world's biggest open-hearth furnace, or as if the world's biggest open-hearth furnace had sprouted legs and was slowly approaching him. Next to that sound, next to the sight of that dull yet titanic red glow, the overturned Derry fire chief's car and the blood inside began to seem a good deal less important. Lester went back to his own car, fought a brief battle with his conscience, and won by promising himself he would stop at the first payphone he came to and call the state police in Cleves Mills. No, Derry. Like most good salesmen, Lester Moran carried a detailed map of his territory in his head, and, after consulting it, he decided Derry was closer. He had to resist the yammering urge to goose the wagon up to its top speed, which was about 60 these days. He expected at every turn of the road to come upon sawhorses blocking the road, a confusion of crazily parked vehicles, the sound of CB radios squealing out messages at top gain, shouting men in hard hats, helmets, and rubber coats. It didn't happen. Instead of sawhorses and a boiling nest of activity, he came upon the overturned Unity pumper, cab broken off its body, the tank itself still spraying the last of its load. Lester, who was now breathing smoke as well as air that would have killed almost anyone else on Earth, stood on the soft shoulder, mesmerized by the limp white arm he saw dangling from the window of the pumper's amputated cab. Rivulets of drying blood ran erratic courses down the arm's white and vulnerable underside. Something wrong here. Something a lot more wrong than just a woods fire. You got to get out, Les. But instead he turned toward the fire again, and was lost. The smoky taste in the air was stronger. The sound of burning was now not a crackle, but a rolling thunder. The truth of it suddenly fell on him like a bucket of cement. No one was fighting this fire. No one at all. For some reason he couldn't understand. They either hadn't been able to get into the area, or hadn't been allowed in. As a result, the fire was burning out of control, and with the freshening wind to help, it was growing like a radioactive monster in a horror movie. The idea made him ill with terror and excitement, and sick, dark joy. It was bad to feel a thing like that last, but it was there, and it was impossible to deny. Nor was he the only one who had felt it. That dark joy had seemed to be a part of every firefighter he had ever bought a drink for, which was almost every firefighter he'd ever met, since he flunked his own BFD physical. He fumbled and stumbled back to his car, started it with some difficulty, assuming that in his excitement he had probably almost flooded the damn dinosaur, boosted the air conditioner all the way up, and headed toward Haven again. He was aware this was idiocy of the purest Ray Serene. He was, after all, not Superman, but a 45-year-old textbook salesman who was going bald, and who was still a bachelor because he was too shy to ask women for dates. He was not just behaving in an idiotic fashion, either. Harsh as that judgment was, it was still a rationalization. The truth was he was behaving like a lunatic. And yet he could no more stop himself than a junkie can stop himself when he sees his fix cooking in the spoon. He couldn't fight it, but he could still go see it. And it would really be something to see, wouldn't it? Lester thought. Sweat was already rolling down his face, as if in anticipation of the heat ahead. Something to see, oh yeah. A forest fire that was for some reason being allowed to rage utterly out of control, as they had millions of years ago, when men were little more than a small tribe of hairless monkeys cowering in the twin cradles of the Nile and the Euphrates, and the great fires themselves were touched off by spontaneous combustion, strokes of lightning, or meteor falls, instead of drunk hunters who didn't give a shit what they did with their cigarette butts. It would be a bright orange furnace, a firewall 90 feet high in the woods. Across the clearings and gardens and hayfields it would race like a Kansas prairie fire in the 1840s, gobbling houses so swiftly they would implode from the sudden change in air pressure, as houses and factories had done during the World War II firebombings. He would be able to see the road he was on, this very road, disappearing into that furnace like a highway into hell. The tar itself, he thought, would first begin to run in sticky little rivulets, and then to burn. He stepped down harder on the gas, and thought, how could you not go on, when you had a chance, a once-in-a-lifetime chance, to see something like that? How could you not? 6.
I just don't know how I'm going to explain to my dad is all, the Maine Med Supplies clerk said.
He wished he had never argued 4 years ago for expanding their business to include rentals in the first place. His father had thrown that in his face after the old guy rented the flat pack and never returned it, and now all hell was breaking loose in Haven. The radio said it was a forest fire, and then went on to hint that even weirder things might be happening there, and he was betting he'd never see the flat pack he had rented that morning to the reporter with the thick glasses either. Now here were two more fellows, state troopers no less, both big, and most unsettling of all, one about as black as a fellow could be, demanding not just one flat pack each, but six of them.
You can tell your dad we requisitioned them,
Torgerson said. I mean, you do provide respiration gear for firemen, don't you?
Yes, but...
And there's a forest fire in Haven, isn't there?
Yes, but...
Then get them out here. I don't have time to bullshit.
My father's gonna kill me, he wailed. That's all we got.
Torgerson had met Claudel Weems pulling into the parking lot of the barracks just as Torgerson himself was pulling out. Claudel Weems, Maine's only black state trooper, was tall. Not as tall as the late Monster Dugan, but a very respectable 6'4". Claudel Weems had one gold tooth in the front of his mouth, and when Claudel Weems moved very close to people, suspects, for instance, or reluctant clerks, and smiled, revealing that sparkling gold incisor, they became very nervous. Torgerson once asked Claudel Weems why this was, and Claudel Weems said he believed it was dat old black magic, and then laughed until the glass in the barracks windows seemed to tremble in its frames. Weems now leaned very close to the clerk, and employed dat old black magic dat he wove so well. When they left Maine Med with the flat packs, the clerk was not really sure what had happened, except that the black fella had the biggest gold tooth he had ever seen in his life. 7. The toothless old man who had sold Leandro the T-shirt stood on his porch and watched expressionlessly as Torgerson's cruiser blasted by. When it was gone, he went inside and made a phone call to a number most people wouldn't have been able to reach. They would have heard the sirening sound, which had infuriated Ann Anderson instead. But there was a gadget on the back of the storekeeper's phone, and soon he was talking to an increasingly harried Hazel MacCready. 8. So, Claudel Weems said cheerfully after craning his neck to look at the speedometer, I see we are driving at just over 90 miles an hour. And since the consensus is that you're probably the shittiest motor vehicle operator in the entire Maine State Police...
What fucking consensus? Torgerson asked.
My fucking consensus, Claudel Weems said. Anyway, that leads to a deduction. The deduction is that I will die very soon. I don't know if you believe in that bullshit about granting a doomed man's last request, but if you do... Maybe you'll tell me what this is all about. If you can, before we receive our engine block implants, that is. Andy opened his mouth, then closed it again.
No, he said. I can't. It's too nuts. Just this much. You may start to feel sick. If you do, put some of that canned air to you right away.
Oh, Christ, Weems said. The air's been poisoned in Haven?
I don't know. I think so.
Oh, Christ, Weems said again. Who spilled what beans? Andy only shook his head.
That's why no one's fighting the fire.
The smoke boiled up from the horizon in a widening swath. Mostly white so far, thank God.
I don't know. I think so. Run one of those bands on the radio.
Weems blinked, as if he thought Torgerson might be crazy.
Which band?
Any band. So Weems began to run the police band, at first getting nothing but the confused, beginning to be frightened babble of cops and firemen who wanted to fight a fire and somehow couldn't get to where it was. Then, further down, they heard a request for backup units at the scene of a liquor store robbery. The address given was 117 Mystic Avenue, Medford. Weems looked at Andy.
Jeepers creepers, Andy. I didn't know there was any Mystic Avenue in Medford. In fact, I didn't think there was any avenues at all in Medford. A couple of pulp roads, maybe.
I think, Andy said, and his voice seemed to be coming to his own ears from very far away, that particular squeal is coming from Medford, Massachusetts. 9. 200 yards over the Haven town line, Lester Moran's motor died. It did not cough, it did not hitch, it did not backfire. It just died, quietly and without fanfare. He got out without bothering to switch off the key. The steady crackle of the fire filled the whole world, it seemed. The air temperature had gone up at least 20 degrees. The wind was carrying the heavy smoke toward him, but up, so the air was breathable. It still had a hot, acrid taste. Here, on the left and right, were wide fields, Clarendon Land on the right, Ruval Land on the left. It rose in a long, undulating slope toward the woods. In those woods, Lester could see steadily brightening winks of red and orange light. Smoke poured up from them in a torrent, which was steadily darkening. He could hear the thumping explosions of hollow trees imploding as the fire sucked the oxygen out of them like marrow from old bones. The wind was not straight into his face, but close enough. The fire was going to break out of the woods and into the field in minutes, seconds maybe. Its rush down to where he stood, face red and running with sweat, might be lethally quick. He wanted to be back in his car before that happened. It would start, of course it would. Old Gal had never failed him yet, and piling up distance between himself and that red oncoming beast.
Go, then. Go, for Christ's sake. You've seen it. Now go.
Thing was, he really hadn't seen it. He'd felt its heat, seen it wink its eyes and fume smoke from its dragon's nostrils, but he really hadn't seen the fire. But then he did. It came out of Luther Ruval's west field in a pounce. The main fire front bore on into Big Engine Woods, but this side now broke free of the forest. The trees massed at the far end of the field were no match for the red animal. They seemed for a moment to grow blacker as the light behind them was turned up, yellow to orange, orange to glare red. Then they simply swept into flame. It happened in an instant. For a moment, Lester could see their tops, and then they were gone, too. It was like the act of some fabulous prestidigitator, the sort of magician Hilly Brown had once wanted to be with all his heart and soul. The fire line was before him, 80 feet high and eating trees, as Lester Moran stood mesmerized, mouth gaping, before it. Flames began to run down the slope of the field. Now the smoke began to rafter around him, thicker, choking. He began to cough.
Get out, for Christ's sake, get out!
Yes, now he would. Now he could. He had seen it, and it was every bit as spectacular as he had expected it would be. But it was a beast. And what a right-thinking man did when confronted with a beast was run. Run just as fast and far as he could. All living things did it. All living things. Lester backed halfway to his car and then stopped. All living things. Yes, all living things ran before a forest fire. The old patterns were suspended. The coyote ran beside the rabbit. But there were no rabbits and no coyotes coming down that field. There were no birds in the gunmetal-colored sky. No one here but him. No birds or animals running from the fire meant there were none in the woods. The overturned FD car, the blood everywhere, the pumper wrecked in the woods, the bloody arm. What's going on here? His mind screamed. He didn't know, but he knew he was putting on those fabled boogie shoes. He pulled the door open and then looked back one final time. What he saw rising out of that great pillar of smoke jerked a scream from him. He drew in smoke, coughed on it, screamed again. Something, some huge something, was rising out of the smoke like the greatest whale in creation slowly breaching. Smoke-hazed sunlight gleamed mellowly on its side, and still it came up, came up, came up, and there was no sound, except for the awkward thunder-crunch strides of the fire. Up, and up, and up. His neck craned to follow its slow, impossible progress. And so he never saw the small, queer thing which came out of the smoke and trundled smartly down the road toward him. It was a red wagon. It had belonged to little Billy Fannin at the beginning of the summer. In the center of the wagon was a platform. On the platform was a Benson brush trimmer, little more than a power blade at the end of a long pole. The blade was controlled by a pistol grip control. A sales tag reading, "Cut up a storm with your Benson," still fluttered from the top of the pole. It was on a moving gimbal and looked a bit like the jutting prow of an absurd ship. Lester was cringing against his car and staring up into the sky when the gadget's EEG sensor, which had begun life as a digital meat probe, triggered the brush trimmer's electronic starter, a modification the Benson designers had never considered. The blade shrieked into life, the small gas motor howling like a hurt cat. Lester turned and saw something like a fishing pole with teeth coming at him. He cried out and ducked toward the rear of his car.
"What's going on here?" his mind screamed. "What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What's—"
The brush trimmer swung on its gimbal, seeking Lester, following his brain waves, which it sensed as neat little pulses, not much different from radar blips. The brush trimmer was not very bright. Its brain came from a programmable toy called the Terrible Tracker Tank. But it was bright enough to stay homed in on the low electrical output of Lester Moran's own brain. His battery, one might say.
"Get out!" Lester screamed as Billy Fannin's wagon trundled toward him. "Get away! Get away!"
Instead, the wagon seemed to leap at him. Lester Moran, his heart hammering wildly in his chest, zigged. The brush trimmer zigged with him. Lester Moran tried to zag, and then a huge, slowly moving shadow fell over him, and he looked up in spite of himself. He just couldn't help it. His feet tangled in each other, and the brush cutter pounced. Its swirling blade chewed into Lester's head. It was still working on him when the fire engulfed both it and its victim. 10. Torgerson and Weems saw the body in the road at the same time. They were both breathing canned air now. Nausea had come on them quickly with frightening power, but with the masks in place it disappeared completely. Leandro had been right. The air, something in the air. Claudel Weems had ceased asking questions after they'd picked up the police band squeal from Massachusetts. After that he only sat with his hands in his lap, his eyes moving steadily and cautiously. Further downtuning had brought them news of police doings in such interesting places as Friday, North Dakota, Arnett, Texas. Torgerson stopped, and the two men got out. Weems paused, then took the riot gun clipped under the dash. Torgerson nodded. Things were starting to come clear. Not sane, but clear. Gavins and Rhodes had disappeared on their way back from this town, and Monster had been here the day before he committed suicide. What was that Phil Collins song, the one with the spooky drums? It was in the air, all right. Gently, Torgerson turned over the man he believed to be the one who had finally blown the whistle on this craziness. He had cleaned up a lot of ugly messes in the highway, but he still drew in a harsh gasp and shied his face away.
"Christ, what hit him?" Weems asked.
The mask muffled his words, but the tone of dismay came through loud and clear. Torgerson didn't know. He had seen a man once who had been hit by a snowplow. That guy had looked a little like this. That was the closest. The guy was blood from the top of what had been his head all the way down to his waist. His belt buckle had been driven deep into his body.
"Christ, man, I'm sorry," he murmured, and laid the body down gently.
He could go for the wallet, but he wanted nothing more to do with that smashed body. He headed for the car. Weems fell in beside him, riot gun held on a slant against his chest. In the distance, to the west, the smoke was growing thicker by the moment, but here there was only a faint woodsy tang.
"This is crazy shit," Weems said through his mask.
"Yes."
"I have a very bad feeling about being here."
"Yes."
"I believe we should vacate this area on the do—"
There was a crackling sound from behind them, and for a moment Torgerson thought it must be the fire. It was far away, relatively speaking, but it could be over here, too, perfectly reasonable. When you were at the Mad Hatter's tea party, anything was. Turning, he realized that the sound was not burning branches, but breaking ones.
"Holy shit!" Claudel Weems cried.
Torgerson's jaw dropped. The Coke machine, stupid but reliable, moved in again. This time it came out of the brush at the side of the road. The glass display front was broken. The sides of the big rectangular box were scratched. And on the metal part of the machine's front, Torgerson saw a horridly suggestive shape driven in so deep it looked almost sculpted. It looked like half a head. The Coke machine moved out over the road,
and just hung there for a moment, like a coffin painted in incongruously gay colors. They were gay, at least, until you noticed the blood, which had dripped and run and was beginning to dry in maroon splotches. Torgerson could hear a faint humming and a clicking sound. Like relays, he thought. Maybe it's been damaged. Maybe. But still. The Coke machine suddenly arrowed straight at them.
"Motherfucker!"
Weems shouted. There was dismay and terror in his voice, but a kind of crazed laughter as well.
"Shoot it! Shoot it!"
Torgerson cried, and leapt to the right. Weems took a step back and promptly fell over Leandro's body. This was extremely stupid. It was also extremely lucky. The Coke machine missed him by inches, as it banked for another run. Weems sat up and pumped three quick shotgun blasts into it. Metal exploded inward in metal daisy shapes with black centers. The machine began to buzz. It stopped, jittering back and forth in the air like a man with Huntington's chorea. Torgerson drew his service pistol and fired four rounds. The Coke machine started for him, but now it seemed lethargic, unable to get up any speed. It jerked to a stop, jerked forward, stopped, jerked forward again. It rocked drunkenly from side to side. The buzzing grew louder. Runnels of soda fell from the access door in sticky rivulets. As it came at him, Torgerson pivoted easily away.
"Drop, Andy!" Weems yelled.
Torgerson dropped. Claudel Weems shot the Coke machine three more times, firing as fast as he could work the pump action. On the third shot, something inside it exploded. Black smoke and a brief belch of fire licked out one side of the machine. Green fire, Torgerson saw. Green. The Coke machine thumped to the road about 20 feet from Leandro's body. It tottered, then fell forward with a hollow bang. Broken glass jingled. There were 3 seconds of silence, then a long, metallic croaking sound. It stopped. The Coca-Cola machine lay dead across the white line in the middle of Route 9. Its red and white hide was full of bullet holes. Smoke poured from it.
"I have just drawn my weapon and killed a Coke machine, sir,"
Claudel Weems said hollowly inside his mask. Andy Torgerson turned toward him.
"And you never even ordered it to halt or fired a warning shot. Probably draw a suspension, you dumb shit."
They stared at each other over the masks and started to laugh. Claudel Weems laughed so hard he was nearly doubled over.
"Green," Torgerson thought.
And although he was still laughing, nothing felt very funny inside where he lived. The fire that came out of that fucker was green.
"Never fired a warning shot," Weems cackled breathlessly. "No, I never did. Never did at all."
"Violated his fucking civil rights," Torgerson said. "Have to be an investigation," Weems laughed. "Yo, baby, I mean.
He tottered on his feet. And there was a lot of Claudel Weems to totter. Torgerson suddenly realized he was dizzy himself. They were breathing pure oxygen, hyperventilating.
"Stop laughing," he shouted, and his voice seemed to come from a long distance away. "Claudel, stop laughing."
He somehow crossed the distance to where Weems was swaying woozily on his feet. The distance seemed very wide. When he was almost there, he stumbled. Weems somehow caught him, and for a moment they stood swaying drunkenly, arms about each other, like Rocky Balboa and Apollo Creed at the end of the first fight.
"You're pulling me down, asshole," Weems muttered.
"Fuck you, you started it."
The world came into focus, wavered, steadied. "Slow breaths," Torgerson told himself. "Big, slow breaths, easy respiration. Be still, my beating heart." That last made him giggle again, but he got hold of it. The two of them wavered back toward the cruiser, arms about each other's waists.
"The body," Weems said.
"Leave it for now. He's dead. We're not. Yet." "Look," Weems said as they passed Leandro's remains. "The bubs. They're out." The blue flashers, called bubbles or bubs by the troopers, on top of the cruiser, were dead and dark. That wasn't supposed to be. Leaving the flashers on at the scene of the accident was ingrained behavior.
"Did you?"
Torgerson began, and then stopped. Something in the landscape had changed. The day had darkened, as it does when a large cloud floats over the sun, or when an eclipse begins. They looked at each other, then turned. Torgerson saw it first, a great silvery shape emerging from the boil of smoke. Its huge leading edge gleamed. "Holy Christ!" Weems almost squealed. His large brown hand found Torgerson's arm and bore down upon it. Torgerson barely felt it, although there would be bruises in the shape of Weems' hand the next day. Up it came, and up, and up. Smoke-hazed sunlight glinted on its silvery metallic surface. It rose on an angle of roughly 40 degrees. It seemed to be wavering slightly, although that could have been an illusion or heat haze. Of course, the whole thing was an illusion. Had to be. No way it could be real, Torgerson thought. It was oxygen rapture. But how can we both be having the same hallucination? Oh, my dear God, Weems groaned. It's a flying saucer, Andy. It's a fucking flying saucer. But to Torgerson, it did not seem like a saucer. It looked like the underside of an army mess plate, the biggest damn plate in creation. Up it came, and up it came. You thought it must end, that a hazy margin of sky must appear between it and the rafters of smoke, but still it came, dwarfing the trees, dwarfing all the landscape. It made the smoke of the forest fire look like a couple of cigarette butts smoldering in an ashtray. It filled more and more of the sky, blotting out the horizon, rising. Oh, something was rising out of Big Engine Woods, and it was deathly silent. There was no sound. No sound at all. They stared at it. And then Weems clutched Torgerson, and Torgerson clutched Weems. They hugged each other like children, and Torgerson thought, "Oh, if it falls on us." And still it came up from the smoke and the fire, and up, as if it would never end. 11. By nightfall, Haven had been cut off from the outside world by the National Guard. The guardsmen surrounded it, those downwind, wearing oxygen equipment. Torgerson and Weems made it out, but not in their cruiser. That was as dead as John Wilkes Booth. They hoofed it. By the time they had used up the oxygen in the last flat pack, swapping it back and forth, they were well into Troy and found themselves able to deal with the outside air. The wind left them lucky, Claudel Weems said later. They walked out of what would soon be referred to as the zone of pollution in top-secret government reports, and theirs was the first official word of what was going on in Haven. But by then there had been hundreds of unofficial reports on the lethal quality of the air in the area, and thousands of reports of a gigantic UFO seen rising from the smoke in Big Engine Woods. Weems made it out with a bloody nose. Torgerson lost half a dozen teeth. Both counted themselves lucky. The initial perimeter, staffed with National Guardsmen from Bangor and Augusta, was thin. By 9 p.m. it had been augmented by guardsmen from Limestone and Presque Isle and Brunswick and Portland. By dawn, 1,000 more battle-equipped guardsmen had been flown in from eastern corridor cities. Between the hours of 7 p.m. and 1 a.m., NORAD stood at DEFCON 2. The president was circling the Midwest at 60,000 feet in looking glass and chewing Tums 5 and 6 at a time. The FBI was on the scene at 6 p.m., the CIA at 7:15 p.m. By 8 o'clock they were yelling about jurisdiction. At 9:15 p.m., a frightened, infuriated CIA agent named Spacklin shot an FBI agent named Richardson. The incident was hushed up, but both Gardner and Bobby Anderson would have understood perfectly. The Dallas police were on the scene, and in complete control of the situation. Chapter 10 Tommyknockers, Knocking at the Door. 1. There was a moment of paralyzed silence in Bobby's kitchen following the misfire of Ev Hillman's old 45.
a silence that was as much mental as it was physical. Guard's wide blue eyes stared into Bobby's green ones.
"You tried," Bobby began, and her mind,
"tried to," produced an echo in Gardner's head. That moment seemed very long, and when it broke like glass. Bobby had dropped the photon pistol to her side in her surprise. Now she brought it up again. There was to be no second chance. In her agitation, her mind was completely open to Gardner, and he felt her shock at the chance she had given him. She intended that there should be no second chance. There was nothing he could do with his right hand. It was under the table. Before she could aim the muzzle of the photon pistol at him, he put his left hand on the edge of the kitchen table and, without thinking, shoved as hard as he could. The table leg squealed harshly on the floor as the table moved. It struck Bobby's lumped and misshapen chest. At the same instant, a beam of brilliant green light shot from the barrel of the toy gun hooked into Hank Buck's big radio tape player. Instead of hitting Guard's own chest, it jerked upward and passed over his shoulder, more than a foot above it, actually, but he could still feel the skin there tingle unpleasantly under the shirt, as if the surface molecules were dancing like drops of water on a hot skillet. Guard twisted to the right and dropped down to get away from that beam of what looked like light. His ribs struck the table, struck it hard, and the table rammed Bobby again, this time even harder. Bobby's chair rocked backward on its rear legs, teetered, and then both it and she toppled over with a crash. The beam of green light swung upward, and Gardner was momentarily reminded of those guys who stand on airport tarmacs at night, using powerful flashlights to guide planes into their berths. He heard a low, crunching, crackling sound, like splintering plywood from overhead, looked up, and saw the photon pistol had drawn a slit in the kitchen ceiling. Gardner staggered to his feet. Incredibly, his jaws cracked and wavered in another yawn. His head clanged and echoed with the grass fire alarm of Bobby's thoughts. "He's got a gun. Tried to shoot me. Bastard, bastard, gun. He's got—" And he tried to shield himself before he went mad. He couldn't. Bobby was screaming inside his head, and as she lay on the floor, pinned for the moment between the table and overturned chair, she was trying to bring the gun to bear on him for another shot. Gardner lifted his foot and shoved the table again, grimacing. It overturned. Beers, pills, and boombox radio all sliding off. Most of the stuff fell on Bobby. Beer splashed in her face and ran, fizzing and foaming over her new and improved skin. The radio hit her neck, then the floor, landing in a shallow puddle of beer. "Flash, you fucker," Gardner screamed at it. "Explode, self-destruct, explode, goddammit, The radio did more than that. It seemed to bulge, and then with a sound like rotten cloth ripping along a seam, it shattered outward in all directions, belching streaks of green fire like bottled lightning. Bobby screamed. What he heard with his ears was bad. The sound inside his head was infinitely worse. Gardner screamed with her, not hearing himself. He saw that Bobby's shirt was burning. He started for her, not thinking about what he was up to. He dropped the .45 as he did so without even thinking. This time it did go off, sending a slug into Jim Gardner's ankle, shattering it. Pain blew through his mind like a hot wind. He screamed again. He took a shambling step forward, his head ringing with her horrid mental cries. They would send him mad in a moment. This thought was actually a relief. When he finally went mad, none of this shit would matter anymore. Then, for one second, Guard saw his Bobby for the last time. He thought perhaps Bobby was trying to smile. Then the screaming began again. She screamed and tried to beat out the flames that were turning her torso to tallow. And that screaming was too much, far too much, too loud, far too loud. It was unbearable. For them both, he thought. He bent, found the triple damned pistol on the floor, and picked it up. He needed to use both of his thumbs to get it cocked. The pain in his ankle was bad. He knew that. But for the moment it was lost to him, buried under Bobby's shrieking agony. He pointed Hillman's pistol at her head. "Work, you goddamn thing! Oh, please, please, work!" But if it worked and he missed, there mightn't be another cartridge in the mag. His motherfucking hands wouldn't stop shaking. He fell to his knees, like a man struck with a sudden violent need to pray. He crawled toward Bobby, who lay shrieking and writhing and burning on the floor. He could smell her,
could see black shards of plastic from the radio's case bubbling their way into her flesh. He almost overbalanced and fell on top of her. Then he pressed the .45 against the side of her neck and pulled the trigger. Another click. Bobby screaming and screaming, screaming inside his head. He tried to pull the slide back again. Almost got it. Then it slipped. Snick! Please, God, oh, please let me be her friend this one last time. This time he got the slide all the way back. He tried the trigger again. This time the gun went off. The scream suddenly became a loud buzz in Gardner's head. He knew he was listening to the mental sound of mortal disconnect. He turned his head upward. A bright stripe of sunlight from the unzipped roof fell across his face, bisecting it. Gardner shrieked. Suddenly the buzzing stopped and there was silence. Bobby Anderson, or whatever she had become, was as dead as the pile of autumn leaf corpses in the control room of the ship, as dead as the galley slaves which had been the ship's drive. She was dead, and Gardner would have gladly died then too. But it still wasn't over. Not yet. 2. Kyle Archenborg was having a Pepsi in Cooter's when the screams began in his head. The bottle dropped from his hand and shattered on the floor as his hands jerked up to his temples. Dave Rutledge, dozing outside Cooter's in a chair which he had caned himself, was tilted back against the building and dreaming weird dreams in alien colors. His eyes snapped open, and he sat bolt upright, as if someone had touched him with a live wire, scrawny tendons standing out on his throat. His chair slid out from under him, and when his head hit the wooden wall of the market, his neck shattered like glass. He was dead before he hit the asphalt. Hazel McCready was making herself a cup of tea. When the screams began, her hands jerked. The one holding the teapot spilled boiling water across the back of the one holding the cup, scalding it badly. She hurled the teapot across the room, screaming in pain and fear. Ashley Ruval, riding his bike past the town hall, fell over into the street and lay there stunned. Dick Allison and Newt Berenger were playing cribbage at Newt's house, a pretty goddamn stupid thing to be doing, since each knew what the other held in his hand. But Newt didn't have a Parcheesi board, and besides, they were only passing time, waiting for the telephone to ring, waiting for Bobby to tell them the drunk was dead, and the next phase of the work could begin. Newt was dealing, and he sprayed cards all over the table and floor. Dick bolted to his feet, eyes wild, hair standing on end, and lurched for the door. He ran into the wall 3 feet to the right of it instead, and went sprawling. Doc Warwick was in his study going over his old diaries. The scream hit him like a wall of cinder blocks being trundled along a set of tracks at brisk speed. His body dumped adrenaline into his heart in lethal quantities, and it blew like a tire. Ad McKean was in his pickup truck, headed over to Newt's. He ran off the road and into Pooch Bailey's abandoned hot dog house. His face hit the steering wheel. He was momentarily stunned, but no more. He had been going slow. He looked around, dazed and terrified. Wendy Fannin was coming up from the cellar with 2 jars of peach preserves. Since her becoming had started, she ate little else. In the last 4 weeks, she had eaten over 90 jars of peach preserves all by herself. She wailed and threw these 2 into the air like a spastic juggler. They came down, struck the stairs, shattered. Peaches and sticky juice ran and dripped. Bobby, she thought numbly, Bobby Anderson's burning up. Nancy Voss was standing blankly at the back window and thinking about Joe. She missed Joe, missed him a lot. She supposed that the becoming would eventually wipe that longing out. Every day it seemed more and more distant. But although it hurt to miss Joe, she didn't want that hurt to stop. It made no sense, but there it was. Then the shrieks began in her head, and she jerked forward so suddenly that she broke 3 of the window panes with her forehead. 3. Bobby's screams blanketed Haven like an air raid siren. Everything and everyone came to a complete stop. And then the changed people of Haven drifted into the streets of the village. Their looks were all one look, dismay, pain, and horror at first. Then anger. They knew who had caused those shrieks of agony. While they went on, no other mental voice could be heard, and the only thing anyone could do was listen to them. Then came the buzzing death rattle, and a silence so complete it could only be death. A few moments later, there was the low pulse of Dick Allison's mind. It was emotionally shaken, but clear enough in its command. Her farm. Everyone. Stop him before he can do anything else. Hazel's voice picked the thought up, strengthening it. The effect was like a second voice joining a first to make a duet. Bobby's farm. Go there, everybody. The beat of Kyle's mental voice made it a trio. The radius of the voice began to spread as it gained strength. Everyone, stop him. Adley's voice, Newt Berenger's voice. Before he can do anything else. Those Gardner thought of as the shed people had welded their voices into one voice of command, clear and beyond denial. Not that anyone in Haven even thought of denying it. Stop him before he can do anything to the ship. Stop him before he can do anything to the ship. Rosalie Scahan left her kitchen sink without bothering to turn off the water running over the cod she had been freshening for supper. She joined her husband, who had been in the backyard chopping wood, and who had barely missed amputating several of his toes when Bobby's screams began. Without a word, they went to their car, got in, and started for Bobby's farm 4 miles away. Turning out of their driveway, they nearly struck Elk Barker, who had taken off from his gas station on his old Harley. Freeman Moss was wheeling his pulp truck. He felt a vague regret. He had sort of liked Gardner. He had what Freeman's pop had called sand, but that wouldn't stop him from tearing the bastard's gizzard out. Andy Bozeman was driving his Oldsmobile Delta 88, his wife sitting beside him with her hands folded neatly on her purse. In it was a molecule exciter, which could raise the spot heat of anything 2 inches in diameter roughly 1,000 degrees in 15 seconds. She was hoping to boil Gardner like a lobster. "Just let me get within 5 feet," she kept thinking. "Just 5 feet, that's all I ask." Beyond that distance, the gadget became unreliable. She knew she could have improved its effectiveness up to half a mile, and now wished she had done so. But if Andy didn't have at least 6 fresh shirts in the closet, he was like a bear. Bozeman himself wore a frozen sneer of rage, lips skinned back from his few remaining teeth in a dry, spitless grin. "I'll whitewash your fence when I get hold of your fuckface," he thought, and pushed the olds up to 90, passing a line of slower-moving cars, all headed for Bobby's place. They all picked up the command voice, which was now a hammering litany. "Stop him before he can do anything to the ship. Stop him before he can do anything to the ship. Stop him! Stop him! Stop him!" 4. Guards stood over Bobby's corpse, half mad with pain and grief and shock. And abruptly, his jaws snapped open in another wide, tendon-stretching yawn. He reeled to the sink, trying to hop, but doing a bad job of it because of the load of dope he'd taken on. Each time he came down on the bad ankle, it felt as if there was a metal claw inside him, relentlessly digging. The dryness in his throat was much worse now. His limbs felt heavy. His thoughts were losing their former acuteness. They seemed to be spreading like broken egg yolks. As he reached the sink, he yawned again and deliberately took a step on the shattered ankle. The pain slashed through the fog like a sharply honed meat cleaver. He barely cracked the tap marked H and got a glass of warm, almost hot water, fumbled in the overhead cabinet, knocking a box of cereal and a bottle of maple syrup onto the floor. His hand closed around the carton of salt with a picture of the little girl on the front. "When it rains, it pours," he thought soupily. "That is very true." He fumbled at the pour spout for what seemed like at least a year, and then spilled enough salt into the glass to turn the water cloudy, stirred it with a finger, chugged it. The taste was like drowning. He retched, bringing up salt water dyed blue. He saw undissolved chunks of blue pills in the vomitus as well. Some looked more or less intact. "How many did you get me to take?" Then he threw up again. 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 It was an encore performance of the projectile vomiting in the woods, some overworked circuit in his brain persistently triggering the gag reflex, a deadly hiccuping that could kill. At last it slowed, then stopped. Pills in the sink, bluish water in the sink, blood in the sink. A lot. He staggered backward, came down on the bad ankle, screamed, fell on the floor. He found himself looking into one of Bobby's glazed eyes across the lumpy terrain of the linoleum, and closed his own. Immediately his mind began to drift away. But in that blackness there were voices. No, many voices blended into one. He recognized it. It was the voice of the shed people. They were coming for him, as he supposed he had always known they would, in time. Stop him! Stop him! Stop him! Get moving, or they won't have to stop you. They'll shoot you or disintegrate you or whatever they want to do to you while you're snoozing on the floor. He got to his knees, then managed to get to his feet with the help of the counter. He thought there was a box of no-dos in the bathroom cabinet, but doubted if his stomach would hold them down after the latest insult he had dealt it. Under other circumstances, it might have been worth the experiment, but Gardner was afraid that if the projectile vomiting started again, it might not stop. Just keep moving. If it gets really bad, take a few steps on that ankle. That'll sharpen you up in a hurry. Would it? He didn't know. All he knew was he had to move fast right now, and wasn't sure he would be able to move for long at all. He hopped staggered to the kitchen door and looked back one final time. Bobby, who had rescued Gardner from his demons time after time, was little more than a hulk now. Her shirt was still smoking. In the end, he hadn't been able to save her from hers, just put her out of their reach. Shot your best friend. Good fucking deal, huh? He put the back of his hand against his mouth. His stomach grunted. He shut his eyes and forced the vomiting down before it could start. He turned, opened them again, and started across the living room. The idea was to look for something solid, hop to it, and then hold on to it. His mind kept wanting to be that silver puffer balloon it became just before he was carried away by the big black twister. He fought it as well as he could, and marked things, and hopped to them. If there was a god, and if he was good, perhaps they all would bear his weight, and he would make it across this seemingly endless room like Moses and his troops had the desert. He knew that the shed people would arrive soon. He knew that if he was still here when they did, his goose wasn't just cooked, it was nuked. They were afraid he might do something to the ship. Well, yes, now that you mentioned it, that was part of what he had in mind, and he knew he would be safest there. He also knew he couldn't go there. Not yet. He had business in the shed first. He made it out onto the porch where he and Bobby had sat up late on so many summer evenings, Peter asleep on the boards between them, just sitting here drinking beers, the Red Sox playing their nightly nine at Fenway or Comiskey Park or some damn place, but playing mostly inside Bobby's radio, tiny baseball men dodging between tubes and circuits, sitting here with cans of beer and a bucket of cold well water, talking about life, death, God, politics, love, literature. Maybe even once or twice about the possibility of life on other planets. Gardner seemed to remember such a conversation or two, but perhaps that was only his tired mind goofing with him. They had been happy here. It seemed a very long time ago. It was Peter his tired mind fixed on. Peter was really the first goal, the first piece of furniture he had to hop to. This wasn't exactly true. The attempted rescue of David Brown had to come prior to ending Peter's torment. But David Brown did not offer him the emotional pulse point he required. He had never seen David Brown in his life. Peter was different. "Good old Peter," he remarked to the still hot afternoon. Was it yet afternoon? By God, it was. He reached the porch steps, and then disaster struck. His balance suddenly deserted him. His weight came down on the bad ankle. This time he could almost see the splintered ends of the bones digging into each other. Gardner uttered a high, mewling shriek. not the scream of a woman, but of a very young girl in desperate trouble. He grabbed for the porch railing as he collapsed sideways. During her frantic early July, Bobby had fixed the railing between the kitchen and the cellar, but had never bothered with the one between the porch and the dooryard. It had been rickety for years, and when Guard put his weight on it, both of the rotted uprights snapped. Ancient wood dust puffed out into the summer sunlight, along with the heads of a few startled termites. Guard pitched sideways off the porch, yelling miserably, and fell into the dooryard with a solid meat thump. He tried to get up, then wondered why he was trying. The world was swaying in front of his eyes. He saw first two mailboxes, then three. He decided to forget the whole thing and go to sleep. He closed his eyes. 5. In this long, strange, and painful dream he was having, Ev Hillman felt, saw Gardner fall, and heard Gardner's thought, "Forget the whole thing, go to sleep." Clearly. Then the dream began to break up, and that seemed good. It was hard to dream. It made him hurt all over, made him ache. And it hurt to combat the green light. If sunlight was too bright, he remembered it a little, sunlight. You could close your eyes, but the green light was inside, always inside. A third eye that saw, and a green light that burned. There were other minds here. One belonged to the woman, the other to the less mind, which had once been Peter. Now the less mind could only howl. It howled sometimes for Bobby to come and let it free from the green light, but mostly it only howled as it burned in the torment of the draining. The woman also screamed for release, but sometimes her thoughts cycled into appalling images of hate that Ev could barely stand. So, yes, better, better, to go to sleep easier, and let it all go. But there was David. David was dying. Already his thoughts, which Ev had received clearly at first, were falling into a deepening spiral that would end first in unconsciousness and then, swiftly, in death. So Ev fought the dark, fought it, and began to call, "Get up! Get up! You out there in sunlight! I remember sunlight! David Brown deserves his time of sunlight, so get up! Get up! Get up! Get—" 6. "Up! Get up! Get up!" The thought was a steady beat in Gardner's head. No, not a beat. It was something like a car, only the wheels were glass. They were cutting into his brain as the car motored slowly across it. "Deserves his time of sunlight! David Brown! Get up! David! Get David up! David Brown! Get up! David Brown! Get up! Get up, damn it!" "All right," Gardner muttered through a mouth that was full of blood. "All right, I hear you. Leave me alone." He managed to get to his knees. He tried to get to his feet. The world grayed out. No good. At least the rasping, cutting voice in his head had let up a little. He sensed its owner was somehow looking out of his eyes, using them like dirty windows, dreaming through them, seeing some of what he saw. He tried to get to his feet again, and was again unable. "My asshole quotient is still very high," Gardner croaked. He spat out two teeth and began to crawl through the dirt of the dooryard toward the shed. 7. Haven came after Jim Gardner. They came in cars. They came in pickup trucks. They came on tractors. They came on motorcycles. Mrs. Eileen Crenshaw, the Avon lady who had been so bored at Hilly Brown's second gala magic show, came driving her son Galen's dune buggy. The Reverend Gooringer rode behind her, the remaining strands of his graying hair blowing back from his sunburned pate. Vern Jernigan came in a hearse he had been trying to convert into a camper before the becoming got into high gear. They filled the roads. Ashley Ruval wove between those on foot like a slalom racer, pedaling his bike like a madman. He had returned home long enough to get something he called a zap gun. This spring it had only been an outgrown toy, gathering dust in the attic. Now, equipped with a 9-volt battery and the circuit board from his little brother's speak and spell, it was a weapon the Pentagon would have found interesting. It blew holes in things. Big holes. This was strapped onto the carrier of his bike, where he had once carried newspapers for delivery. They came in a ripping hurry, and there were some accidents. 2 people were killed when Early Hutchinson's VW collided with the Fannin's station wagon, but such minor things stopped no one. Their mental chant filled the hollow spaces in the air with a steady rhythmic cry, "Before he can do anything to the ship! Before he can do anything to the ship!" It was a fine summer's day, a fine day for killing, and if anyone needed killing, it was James Eric Gardner. And so they came, well over 500 of them in all, good country people who had learned some new tricks. They came, and they brought their new weapons with them. 8. By the time Gardner got halfway to the shed, he began to feel better. Perhaps he was getting a second wind. More likely, he supposed, was the possibility that he really had gotten rid of almost all the Valium and was now starting to get on top of the rest. Or maybe the old man was somehow feeding him strength. Whatever it was enough to get him on his feet again and hopping toward the shed. He clutched at the door for a moment, heart galloping wildly in his chest. He happened to glance down and saw a hole in the door. It was round. The edges stuck out in a jagged bracelet of white splinters. It had a chewed look, that hole. The vacuum cleaner that ran the buttons. This is how it got out. It had a new and improved cutting attachment. Christ, these people really are crazy. He worked his way around the building, and a cold certainty came to him. The key would be gone. Oh, Christ, guard, give it a rest. Why would it... But it was. It was gone. The nail where it had hung was empty. Gardner leaned against the side of the shed, exhausted and trembling, his body sheened with sweat. He looked down, and the sun gleamed off something on the ground. The key. The nail slanted down a bit. He had put the key back in a hurry, and had probably pulled the nail down a bit in the soft wood himself. It had simply slid off. He bent painfully, picked it up, and began to shamble around to the front again. He was exquisitely aware of how fast time was passing. They would arrive soon. How could he possibly get his business done in the shed and then get out to the ship before they did? Since it was impossible, it was probably best to ignore it. By the time he got back to the shed door, he could hear the faint sound of motors. He stabbed the key at the lock and missed the keyway. The sun was bright, his shadow little more than a puddle hanging from his heels. Again. This time the key socked home. He turned it, shoved the door open, and lurched into the shed. Green light enfolded him. It was strong. Stronger than it had been the last time he was here. That big piece of cobbled-together equipment, the transformer, was glowing brightly. It was cycling, as it had been before, but the cycles were faster now. Thin green fire ran across the silvery road maps of circuit boards. He looked around. The old man, floating in his green bath, was looking back at Gardner with his one good eye. That gaze was tortured, but sane. "Use the transformer to save David." "Old man, they're coming for me," Gardner croaked. "I'm out of time." "Corner, far corner." He looked and saw something that looked a bit like a television antenna, a bit like a large coat-hanger mobile, and a bit like those backyard devices on which women hang clothes, turning them to do so. "That? Take it out into the dooryard." Gardner didn't question. There was no time. The thing stood on a small square platform. Gardner supposed its circuits and batteries were in that. Close up, he saw that the things which looked like the bent arms of a TV antenna were really narrow steel tubes. He seized the central pole. The thing wasn't heavy, but it was awkward. He was going to have to put some weight on his shattered ankle, like it or not. He looked back at the tank in which Ev Hillman floated. "You sure about this, old-timer?" But it was the woman who answered. Her eyes opened. Looking into them was like looking into the witch's cauldron in Macbeth. For a moment, Gard forgot all his pain and weariness and sickness. He was held in thrall by that poisoned gaze. In that instant, he understood all the truth and all the power of the fearsome woman Bobby had called Sissy, and the reason Bobby had fled from her, as from a fiend. She was a fiend. She was a witch. And even now, in her fearful agony, her hate held.
"Take it, you stupid man! I'll run it!"
Gardner put his hurt foot down and screamed as a savage hand reached all the way up from his ankle to seize the soft double sack of his testicles. The old man, "Wait, wait!" It rose on its own. Not far, only an inch or two. The green swamp light brightened even more.
"You'll have to guide it, son."
This he was able to manage. It wavered across the green shed like the skeleton of a crazy beach umbrella, nodding and dipping, casting weird, elongated shadows on the walls and floor. Gardner hopped clumsily after it, not wanting, not daring to look back into that insane woman's eyes. Over and over his mind played a single thought. Bobby Anderson's sister was a witch, a witch, a witch. He guided the bobbing umbrella out into the sunlight. 9. Freeman Moss arrived first. He swung the pulp truck in which Gard had once hitched a ride into Bobby's dooryard and was out almost before the laboring, farting engine had died. And by Christ, chummy, if the cocksucker wasn't right there, front and center, holding on to something that looked like a woman's clothes whirligig. Man looked like a winded runner. He was holding one of his feet, the left, up, like a dog with a thorn in his paw. That sneaker was bright red, dripping blood. "Looks like Bobby put at least one good one into you, you snake." Her murdering pal apparently heard the thought. He looked up and smiled wearily. He was still holding on to the whirligig with the platform stand on the bottom. He was supporting himself on it. Freeman walked toward him, leaving the driver's door of the old truck hanging open. There was something childlike and winning in the man's grin, and in a moment Freeman understood what it was. With his missing teeth, it was the Halloween punkin grin of a little boy.
"Jesus, I sorta liked you. Why'd you have to be such a fuck-up?"
"What you doing out here, Freeman?" Gardner asked. "You should have stuck home. Watch the Red Sox. The fence is all whitewashed."
"You son of a whore!"
Moss was wearing a down-filled vest, but no shirt beneath. The vest was simply the first thing to come to hand as he rushed out of the house. Now he brushed it aside, revealing not a gimmick or a gadget, but a Colt Woodsman. He pulled it out. Gardner stood looking at him, holding the whirligig's post foot up. "Close your eyes. I'll make it quick. I can do that, at least." 10.
"Get down, asshole. Get down or you'll lose your head when he loses his. I don't give a tin shit who goes, so get down if you want to live."
In the tank, Ann Anderson's eyes blazed with stricken hate and fury. Her teeth were gone, but her bare gums ground together, ground together, ground together, and a trail of small bubbles floated up. The light pulsed faster and faster, like a carousel speeding up. It became strobe-like. The hum rose to a low electric moan, and there was a rich smell of ozone in the shed's air. On the one lit VDT screen, the word "program" was replaced with "Destroy." It began to flash rapidly, over and over again.
"Get down, asshole, or stay up. I don't care which."
11. Gardner ducked. His bad foot hit the ground. Pain leaped up his leg again. He dropped into the dust on his hands and knees. Over his head, the whirligig began to spin, slowly at first. Moss stared at it, the gun sagging slightly for a moment in his hand. Realization crossed his face during the last instant he still had one. Then the slender pipe spilled green fire into the dooryard. For a moment, the beach umbrella illusion was perfect and complete. It looked exactly like a big green one that has been partially lowered so that its circular hem touches the ground. But this umbrella was made of fire, and Gard crouched below it, eyes squinted, one hand in front of his face, grimacing as if from strong heat. But there was no heat, at least not here, underneath Sissy's poisoned toadstool. Freeman Moss was at the edge of the parasol. His pants blazed up, then the down vest. For a moment the flames were green, then they flared yellow. He screamed and staggered backward, dropping the gun. Over Gardner's head, the whirligig spun faster. The skeletal metal arms, which had drooped comically downward, were pulled more and more erect by centrifugal force. The parasol's fire hem belled outward, and Moss's shoulders and face were enveloped in sheeting flame as he backed away. In Gard's head, that hideous mental wailing began again. He tried to block it out, but there was no way, simply no way. He caught a wavery glimpse of a face running like warm chocolate, then covered his face like a kid at a scary movie. The flames spun around Bobby's dooryard in a widening gyre, making a black spiral of dooryard dirt fuse into a gritty sort of glass. Moss's pulp truck and Bobby's blue pickup were both in the thing's final circumference. The shed was barely beyond it, although its shape danced like a demon in the heat haze. It was very hot at the edge of the circle, if not where Gard crouched, no doubt of that. The paint on the hood of Moss's truck and on the sides of the pickup first bubbled, then blackened, then burst into flame, burning down to clean white steel. The litter of bark, sawdust, and wood chips in the back of Moss's truck blazed up like dry kindling in a wood stove. The two big trash barrels in Bobby's pickup, made of heavy pressed gypsum, also caught fire and burned like sconces. The dark circle at the edge of the fire parasol's range became a brand in the shape of a saucer. The army blanket covering the torn seat in the cab of Moss's truck sprang alight, then the seat covers beneath, then the tindery stuffing. Now the entire cab was flickery furnace orange, with the skeletons of springs peering up through the glare. Freeman Moss staggered backward, twisting and turning, looking like a movie stuntman who has forgotten his flame suit. He collapsed. 12. Even overmastering Moss's dying screams, Ann Anderson's mental cry, "Eat shit and die! Eat shit and d—" Then suddenly, something let go in whatever remained of her. There was a final brilliant flare of green light, a sustained pulse that lasted nearly 2 seconds. The heavy hum of the transformer rose a notch, and every board in the shed picked it up and rattled in sympathetic vibration. Then the hum dropped back to its former sleepy drone. Anne's head slumped forward in the liquid, her hair trailing like that of a drowned woman. On the computer screen, "Destroy" winked out like a blown candle and became "Program again." 13. The fiery parasol wavered, then disappeared. The whirligig, which had been spinning at a mad rate, began to slow, squeaking rhythmically, like an unlatched gate in a mild breeze. The pipes sank back to their former angle. It squeaked once more, then stopped. The gas tank of Bobby's truck suddenly exploded. More yellow flames spouted at the sky. Gard felt a piece of metal whiz by him. He raised his head and stared stupidly at the blazing truck, thinking, "Bobby and I used to go to the Starlight Drive-In over in Derry in that truck sometimes. I think we even got laid there once during some stupid Ryan O'Neill picture. What happened? Lord, what happened?" In his mind, the old man's voice, almost exhausted but somehow imperative, "Quick, I can power the transformer when the rest come, but you gotta be quick. The boy, David, quick, man." "Not much time," Gardner thought wearily. "Jesus, there never is." He started back toward the open door of the shed, sweating, cheeks waxy pale. He paused at that dark, burned ring in the dirt, and then hopped clumsily over it. He somehow didn't want to touch it. He tottered on the edge of balance, and then managed to hop on. As he made his way back inside the shed, the twin gas tanks of Moss's truck went up with a furious roar. The cab tore free of the body. The truck flipped over on its side like a tiddlywink. Burning chunks of seat cover and seat stuffing began to float out of the open passenger window and floated upward like blazing feathers. Most fell back into the dooryard and went out.
A few, however, wafted their way over to the porch, and three or four actually floated through the open door on the first faint puff of the easterly wind which would soon come up. One of these burning cotton puffs alighted on a paperback novel which Gardner had left on the table just inside the door a week ago. The cover caught on fire. In the living room, another burning fragment of seat stuffing lit up a rag rug which Mrs. Anderson had made in her bedroom and sent surreptitiously to Bobby one day when Anne was gone. When Jim Gardner came out of the shed again, the entire house was on fire. 14. The light in the shed was at its lowest level ever, a dim and watery green, the color of stagnant pond water. Gardner looked cautiously toward Anne, afraid of those blazing eyes. But there was nothing to be afraid of. She only floated, head bent forward as if in deep thought, her hair trailing upward. "She's dead, son. If you're going to get the boy, it has to be now. I don't know how long I can provide the power. And I can't be divided, with half of myself looking out for them, and half running the transformer." He stared out at Gardner, and Gard felt deep pity and admiration for the old bastard's brute courage. Could he have done half as much, gone half as far, if their positions had been reversed? He doubted it. "You're in a lot of pain, aren't you?"
"I ain't exactly feeling in the pink, son, if that's what you mean. But I'll get through it. If you get going, that is."
Get going, yes, he had dilly-dallied too long. Far too long. His mouth popped open in another wrenching yawn, and then he stepped toward the equipment in and around that orange crate, what the old man called the transformer. "Program?" the keyless computer screen beckoned. Hillman could have told Gardner what to do, but Gardner didn't need to be told. He knew. He also remembered the nosebleed and the blast of sound he'd taken as a result of his single experiment with Moss's levitation gadget. This made that thing look like a box of Lincoln Logs. Still, he had gone quite a ways down the path to becoming himself since then, like it or not. He would just have to hope it was enough. "Oh, shit, son, hold the phone. We got company." Then a louder voice overrode Hillman's, a voice Gard vaguely recognized but could not put a name to. "Back off, back off. Hold on, all of you."
Just one, or maybe two."
That was the old man's exhausted mental voice again. Gardner felt his concentration go out to the whirligig in the dooryard. In the shed, the light began to grow bright once more, and the killing pulses began. 15. Dick Allison and Newt Berenger were still 2 miles from Bobby's place when Freeman Moss's mental shrieks began. Moments before, they had swerved past Elt Barker. Now Dick looked up into the rearview mirror and saw Elt's Harley swerve across the road and go leaping through the air. For a moment, Elt looked like Evel Knievel, white hair or no. Then he separated from the bike and landed in the scrub. Newt hit the brakes with both feet, and his truck screamed to a stop in the middle of the road. He looked at Dick with large eyes that were both frightened and furious.
"Son of a bitch has got a gadget."
"Yeah, fire. Some kind of..." Abruptly, Dick raised his mental voice to a shout. Newt picked it up, amplified it. From Kyle Archenborg's Cadillac, Kyle and Hazel McCready joined in. "Back off! Back off! Hold on, all of you!" They stopped, holding their positions. They were not great takers of orders as a rule, these Tommyknockers, but Moss's hideous screams, fading now, were great persuaders. All stopped, that was, except for a blue Oldsmobile Delta 88 with a bumper sticker on the back reading, "Realtors sell it by the acre." When the command came to back off and hold position, Andy Bozeman was already in sight of the Anderson place. His hate had grown exponentially. Gardner, lying bleeding and dead, was all he could think of. He came slewing into Bobby's driveway in a wild power turn. The Olds' rear end broke free when Bozeman stamped the brake.
The big car nearly tipped over. "I'll whitewash your fence, you fucking asshole. I'll give you a dead rat and a string to swing it on. Oh, you bastard!"
His wife pulled the molecule exciter out of her purse. It looked like a Buck Rogers blaster, which had been created by a fairly bright lunatic. Its frame had once been part of a garden tool, marketed under the trade name of Weed Eater. She leaned out the car window and pulled the trigger utterly at random. The east end of Bobby's farmhouse exploded into a cauldron of fire. Ida Bozeman grinned a cheerful, reptilian grin. As the Bozemans began to get out of the olds, the whirligig started to spin. A moment later, the green parasol of flame began to form. Ida Bozeman tried to aim what she called her molecule disco at it, but too late. If her first shot had hit the whirligig instead of the house, everything might have been different. But it didn't. The two of them went up like fire trees. A moment later, the olds exploded, with three payments still due on it. 16. Now, with the screams of Freeman Moss just beginning to fade from their minds, the screams of Andy and Ida Bozeman took their place. Newt and Dick waited them out, grimacing. At last they faded. Ahead, Dick Allison could see other vehicles parked on both sides of Route 9 and in the middle. Frank Spruce was leaning out of the cab of his big tanker truck, looking toward Newt and Dick urgently. They sensed the others, all the others on this road, on other roads. Some were standing in the fields they had been cutting across. All of them waiting for something, some decision. Dick turned toward Newt. "Fire. Yes, fire. Can we put it out?" There was a short mental silence as Newt thought about it. Dick could sense him wanting to simply push it aside and go on to where Gardner was. What Dick wanted wasn't complicated. He wanted to rip out Jim Gardner's gizzard. But that wasn't the answer, and they both knew it. All the shed people, even Adley, knew it. The stakes were higher now, and Dick was confident Jim Gardner was going to lose his gizzard anyway, in one fashion or another. Crossing the Tommyknockers was a bad idea. It made them mad. This was a truth many races on other worlds had found out long before today's festivities in Haven. He and Newt both looked out toward the tree-bordered field where Elt Barker had crashed. The grasses and the plumes of the trees were blowing, not hard, but clearly blowing in a wind which blew from east to west. Not even enough breeze to qualify as a kappa wind, but Dick thought it showed signs of brisking. "Yes, we can put out the fire," Newt replied at last. "Stop the fire and the drunk, too? Can we be sure of that?" Another long, thinking pause, and then Newt came to the answer that Dick had already suspected. "I don't know if we can do both. I know one or the other, but I don't know if we can do both." "Then we'll let the fire burn for now. We'll let it burn, yes, all right. The ship will be all right. The ship will not be hurt, and the wind, the way the wind's blowing." They looked at each other, grinning, as their thoughts came together in a moment of utter, chiming harmony. One voice, one mind. The fire will be between him and the ship. He won't be able to get to the ship. On the roads and in the fields, the people listening in on this party line all relaxed slightly. "He won't be able to get to the ship." "Is he still in the shed?" "Yes." Newt turned his puzzled, troubled face to Dick. "What the fuck's he doing in there? Does he have something, making something, something to hurt the ship?" There was a pause, and then Dick's voice, not just to Newt Barringer, but to all the shed people, clear and imperative. "Net your minds. Net your minds with ours. All who can, net your mind with ours and listen. Listen for Gardiner. Listen." They listened. In the hot summer silence of the early afternoon, they listened. Two or three ridges over, the first smudges of smoke rose into the sky. 17. Gardner felt them listening. There was a horrid crawling sensation over the surfaces of his brain.
It was ridiculous, but it was happening. He thought, now I know how a streetlight must feel with a lot of moths fluttering around it. The old man moved in his tank, trying to catch Gardner's eye. He missed his eye, but caught his mind. Gardner looked up. Never mind, son. They want to know what you're up to, but forget 'em. Won't hurt if they find out. Might even help. Slow 'em down. Relieve their minds. They don't care about David. Only their goddamn ship. Go on, son. Go on. Gardner was standing by the transformer and holding one of the earplugs in his hand. He didn't want to put it in. He felt like a man who's gotten a hefty shock from one particular switchplate, who is compelled to touch that same switchplate again. Do I really have to wear this fucker? I changed the screen just by thinking before. Yes, and that's all you can do. You got to wear it, son. I'm sorry. Incredibly, Gardner's eyelids were growing heavy again. He had to force them up. I'm afraid it will kill me, he thought at the old man, and then waited, hoping the old man would contradict him. But there was nothing, only the pained eye looking at him, and the dim slish, slish, slish of the equipment. Yeah, it may kill me, and he knows it, too. Outside, dimly, he could hear the crackle of fire. The fluttering feeling along the surfaces of his mind stopped. The moths had flown away. Reluctantly, Gardner put the plug in his ear. 18. Kyle and Hazel relaxed. They looked at each other. There was an identical and very human expression in their eyes, the expression of people discovering something just too good to be true. David Brown? Kyle thought, unbelieving, at Hazel. Is that what you... Pick up, yes, he's trying to save the kid, to bring him back. Back from Altair 4. Then, for a moment, overriding the net, came Dick Allison's voice, excited and full of sour triumph. Hot damn! I knew that kid would come in handy. 19. For a moment, Gardner felt nothing at all. He began to relax, on the edge of a doze again. Then pain hit him in a single awful crunch, a destructive battering ram that would tear his head apart. No! He screamed. His hands went to his temples. Beat against them. No! God, no! It hurts too much! Jesus, no! Ride with it, son. Try to ride with it. I can't! I can't! Oh, Christ, make it stop! This made his shattered ankle feel like a mosquito bite. He was dimly aware that his nose was bleeding and that his mouth was filled with blood. Ride with it, son! The pain backed off a little. It was replaced with another feeling. This new sensation was horrible. Horrible and terrifying. Once, while in college, he had participated in something called the Great McDonald's Eat Out. Five frats had fielded champion eaters. Guard had been Delta Tau Delta's champ. He had been on his sixth Big Mac, not even close to the contest winner's eventual total, and had become suddenly aware that he was very close to total physical overload. He had never felt anything like it in his life. In a gross way, it was almost interesting. His midsection felt thundery with food. He did not feel like vomiting. Nausea did not exactly describe what it had been like. He saw his stomach as a huge, still dirigible, lying bloated in still air at his center. He thought he could sense red lights going on in some mental mission control center as various systems tried to deal with this insane load of meat, bread, and sauce. He didn't vomit. He walked it off. Very slowly, he walked it off. For hours, he had felt like those drawings of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, his stomach stretched and smooth and terribly close to bursting. Now it was his mind that felt like that, and Jim Gardner understood as coldly and rationally as a trapeze performer who works with no net that he was on the knife edge of death. But there was another sensation, one which was unrelatable to anything. And for the first time he understood what the Tommyknockers were all about, what moved them, what propelled them onward. In spite of the pain, which had only retreated, not left, and in spite of that dreadful smooth feeling of being as stuffed as a python which has swallowed a kid, part of him was enjoying this. It was like a drug, an incredibly powerful drug. His brain felt like the engine in the biggest fucking Chrysler ever built, idling on fat gas, waiting for him to drop the car into gear and peel out. Peel out to where? Anywhere. The stars, if he wanted. "Son, I'm losing you." That was the old man, sounding more exhausted than ever, and Gardner pulled himself back to the job at hand, the next piece of furniture he had to hop to. Oh, this feeling was drunkenly wonderful. But it was stolen. He forced himself to think again of those leaf-brown shapes locked in all those hammocks. Galley slaves. The old man was powering him. He was drinking the old man like a vampire drinking blood. How long until he was a vampire himself? Like them. He thought at Hillman, "I am with you, old horse." Ev Hillman closed his one good eye in silent relief. Guard turned to the monitor screen, absently holding the plug in his ear like a newsman on a live remote listening to a question from the anchor back in the studio. In the closed space of Bobby's shed, the light began to cycle up again. 20. Listen. They all listened. They were all on a party line which covered all of Haven, radiating out from a center about 2 miles from that still faint smudge of smoke. They were all on the net, and they all listened. They accepted no absolute common. Tommyknockers was a name they accepted as casually as any, but they were really interstellar gypsies with no king. Yet in this moment of crisis, during the period of regeneration, a period when they were so vulnerable, they were willing to accept the voices of those Gardner called the Shed People. They were, after all, the clearest distillation of them all. "The time has come to close the borders." There was a universal sigh of agreement, a mental sound Ruth McCausland would have recognized, a sound like autumn leaves blown before a November wind. For the time being, at least, the Shed People had lost all contact with Gardner. They were only content that he was occupied elsewhere. If he meant to go to their ship, the fire would soon be in his way. The unified voice quickly explained the rota that was to be followed. Some of these plans had been made, vaguely, weeks ago. These plans had become more concrete as the Shed People became. Gadgets had been made, haphazardly it had seemed. But birds flying south as winter approaches may seem haphazard. Their migration may even seem so to themselves. Just something which felt like as good a way as any to spend the winter months. "Want to go to North Carolina, dear?" "Of course, my love. What a wonderful idea." So they had built, and sometimes they had killed each other with their new toys, and sometimes they had finished gadgets, looked at them doubtfully, and packed them away somewhere out of sight, since they were no obvious help in their daily round. But some they had toted out to Haven's borders, usually in the trunks of cars or in the backs of trucks under tarps. One of these gadgets had been the Coke machine which had murdered John Leandro. It had been customized by the late Dave Rutledge, who had once serviced such machines for a living. One had been the Benson brush trimmer, which had cut up a storm on Lester Moran. There were duded-up televisions which shot fire. There were smoke detectors. Gardner had seen some, but not all of these, on his first visit to the shed, which flew through the air like frisbees, emitting killing waves of ultrasonic sound. At several locations there were force barriers. Almost all of these gadgets could be mentally activated with the help of simple electronic devices which were casually dubbed callers, not much different from the device Freeman Moss had used to float the drainage machinery into the woods. No one thought more about why these gadgets should be placed in a rough perimeter around the town than a bird thinks about flying south or a caterpillar thinks about weaving a cocoon. But, of course, this time always came, the time when the borders had to be sealed. This time had come early, but, it seemed, not too early. The shed people also suggested that a number of Tommyknockers go back to the village. Hazel MacCready was designated to go with them. She would be the representative of the more advanced Tommyknockers. The stuff protecting the borders would run pretty much without supervision until the batteries were dead. In the village, there were more discretionary gadgets, which could be sent into the woods to form a protective net around the ship, in case the drunk made a break for it. And there was one other very important gadget, which needed guarding on the off chance that anyone at all, should break through. This gadget sat in Hazel MacCready's backyard, like a one-ring circus under a large five-man tent. It was the safety net. It would do many of the things the transformer in the shed could do, but this thing, which had once been a furnace, was vitally different from the transformer in the shed in two respects. The galvanized aluminum pipes, which had once led to the ventilators in the various rooms of the MacCready house, now all pointed skyward. Hooked up to this new and improved furnace, on two plywood ramps protected from the elements by more of the silvery netting which lined the trench in which the ship lay, were 24 truck batteries. When this gadget was turned on, it would make air. Tommyknocker air. Once this small atmosphere manufacturing factory was in operation, they would no longer be at the mercy of winds and weather. Even in the event of a hurricane, the air exchanger, which had been surrounded by force shields, would protect most of them if they gathered in the village. The suggestion that the border should be closed came as Gardner was putting one of the transformer earphones into his own ear. 5 minutes later, Hazel and about 40 others had dropped out of the net and were headed back to town, some to the town hall to oversee the borders and protect the ship with other gadgets, some to make sure the atmosphere factory was protected in case of accident, or in case the reaction from the outside world was quicker, more informed, and better organized than they expected. All these things had happened before, at other times, on other worlds, and affairs were usually concluded in a satisfactory fashion. But the becoming did not always have a happy ending. During the 10 minutes between the command to close the borders and the departure of Hazel's party, the size and shape of the smoke rising into the sky did not change appreciably. The wind was not rising much, at least not yet. This was good, because the attention of the outside world would be slower in turning toward them. It was bad, because Gardner would not be cut off from the ship so soon. Still, Newt, Dick, Adley, Kyle thought Gardner's goose was just about cooked. They held the remaining Tommyknockers in place for 5 minutes, waiting for mental notice that the gadgets along the borders were waking up, getting ready to do their jobs. This came as an awakening hum. Newt looked at Dick. Dick nodded. The two of them dropped out of the net and turned their attention back to the shed. Gardner, who had once been impossible for even Bobby to pick up, was still a tough nut to crack. But they should have been able to read the transformer with no trouble at all. Its steady, heavy pulses of energy should have been as easy for them to hear as RF interference on a TV or radio from the small motor in an electric mixer. But the transformer was barely a whisper, no more than the dim sound of the ocean in a conch shell. Newt looked at Dick again, frightened. "Jesus, he's gone. Motherfuckers." Dick smiled. He did not believe that Gardner, who could still barely thought read or send at all, could have accomplished his purpose so quickly, if it had ever been possible for him to accomplish at all. The man's presence here, and Bobby's perverse affection for him, had been a nuisance, one which Dick now believed at an end. He winked one of his strange eyes at Newt. This odd mixture of human and alien was both hideous and hilarious at the same time.
"Not gone, Newt. The asshole's dead."
Newt looked at Dick thoughtfully for a moment, then began to smile. They moved in, all of them together, drawing in toward Bobby's house like a tightening noose. 21.
Carrying a heavy head.
The phrase chimed constantly in the back of Guard's mind as he turned toward the monitor screen. It seemed to have been there for a long time. Once, and for a Jim Gardner that no longer existed, his poems had formed around such lines, like pearls around chips of grit. "Carrying a heavy head now, boss." Was it from some chain gang movie, like Cool Hand Luke? A song? Yeah, some song. Something which seemed oddly mixed in his mind. Something from the West Coast 60s, a waif-faced psychedelic flower child wearing a Hell's Angels jacket and carrying a bike chain wrapped around one thin white violinist's hand. Your mind, guard. Something happening to your mind. Yeah, you're fucking A, Big Daddy. I'm carrying a heavy head, that's what. I was born to be wild. I've been caught in the crosstown traffic, and if they say I never loved you, you know they are a liar. Carrying a heavy head. I can feel every vein, artery, and capillary in it swelling up, getting plump, standing out the way the veins on our hands used to when we were kids, and wrapped a dozen rubber bands around our wrists and left them there to see what would happen. Carrying a heavy head. If I looked into a mirror right now, I know what I'd see. Green light spilling out of my pupils, like the pencil beams of flashlights. Heavy head. And if you joggle it, it will burst. Yes, so be careful, guard. Be careful, son. Yeah, old man, yeah. David, yeah. That feeling of dipping and swaying out over the drop. He remembered the news film of Carl Wallenda, that grand old man of the aerialists, falling from the wire in Puerto Rico, gripping for the line, finding it, holding for a minute, then gone. Gardner dismissed it from his mind. He tried to dismiss everything from his mind, and prepared to be a hero, or die trying. 22. Program? Guard pushed the earphone deep into his ear and frowned at the screen. Drove the heavy ram of his thoughts toward it. Felt pain flare. Felt the balloon of his brain swell a little more. The pain faded. The feeling of increased swelling remained. He stared at the screen. Altair 4. Okay, what next? He listened for the old man to tell him, but there was nothing. Either his mental link to the Transformer had excluded the old man, or the old man didn't know. Did it really matter which? Nope. He looked at the screen. Cross-file with... The screen suddenly filled up with nines, from top to bottom and side to side. Gardner stared at this with consternation, thinking, "Oh, Jesus Christ, I broke it." The nines disappeared for just a moment. "Oh, Jesus Christ, I broke it," glimmered on the screen like a ghost. Then the screen showed, "Cross-file ready." He relaxed a little. The machine was okay. But his brain really was stretched to capacity, and he knew it. If this machine, which was being powered by the old man and whatever was left of Peter, could bring the boy back, he might actually be able to walk away, or hop, considering his ankle. But if it was going to try to draw from him as well, his brain would pop like a party noisemaker. But this really wasn't the time to think of that, was it? Licking his lips with his numb tongue, he looked at the screen. Cross-file with David Brown. Nines across the screen. Nines for eternity. Cross-file successful. Okay, good. What next? Gardner shrugged. He knew what he was trying to do. Why dance? Bring David Brown back from Altair 4. Nines across the screen. Two eternities this time. Then a message appeared which was so simple, so logical, and yet so loony, that Guard would have screamed laughter if he hadn't known to do so would be to blow every working circuit he had left. Where do you want to put him? The urge to laugh passed. The question had to be answered. Where indeed? Home plate at Yankee Stadium? Piccadilly Circus? On the breakwater, jutting out from the beach in front of the Alhambra Hotel? None of those places, of course not. But not here in Haven. Christ, no. Even if the air didn't kill him, which it probably would, his parents were turning into monsters. So, where? He looked up at the old man, and the old man was looking back at him urgently. And suddenly it came to him. There was really only one place to put him, wasn't there? He told the machine. He waited for it to ask for further clarification, or to say it couldn't be done, or to suggest a system of commands he would be unable to execute. Instead, there were more nines. This time they stayed forever. The green pulsing from the transformer became almost too bright to look at. Guard closed his eyes, and in the greenish deep-sea darkness behind his lids he thought he could hear, faintly, the old man screaming. Then the power that had filled his mind left. Bingo! It was gone, just like that. Gardner staggered backward, the earphone popping free and hitting the floor. His nose was still bleeding, and he had soaked a fresh shirt. How many pints of blood were in the human body? And what had happened? There had been no transfer successful, or transfer unsuccessful, or even a tall, dark Tommyknocker will enter your life. What had it all been for? He realized miserably that he was never going to know. Two lines of Edwin Arlington Robinson came to him. So on we worked and waited for the light, and went without the meat and cursed the bread. No light, boss, no light. If you wait for it, they'll burn you in your tracks, and here's a fence ain't even half whitewashed yet. No light, just a dull, blank screen. He looked toward the old man, and the old man was lolling forward, head down, exhausted. Gardner was crying a little. His tears were mixed with blood. Dull pain radiated from the plate in his head, but that stuffed, near-to-bursting feeling was gone. So was the sense of power. He missed the latter, he discovered. Part of him longed for it to come back, no matter what the consequences. Get moving, guard. Yes, okay. He had done what he could for David Brown. Maybe something had happened. Maybe nothing. Maybe he had killed the kid. Maybe David Brown, who had probably played with Star Wars action figures and wished he could meet an E.T. like Elliot had in the movie, was now just a cloud of dissipating atoms somewhere in deep space, between Altair 4 and here. It was not for him to know. But he had reached this piece of furniture and held it long enough. Too long, maybe. He knew it was time to move on. The old man raised his head. Old man, do you know? If he's safe? No. But, son, you did your best. I thank you. Now, please, please, son, please. Fading, the old man's mental voice was fading. Please let me out of this. Down a long hallway and look on one of those shelves back there. Now Gardner had to strain to hear. Please, oh, please. Faint, a whisper. The old man's head lolling forward. Remains of thin white hair floating in green brew. Peter's legs moved dreamily as he chased rabbits in his dim sleep, or looked for Bobby, his darling. Guard hopped over to the back shelves. They were dark, dusty, greasy. Here were old forgotten bus fuses, and a Maxwell House can full of bolts and washers and hinges, and keys with locks whose location and purpose had long since been forgotten. On one of these shelves was a Transco Sonic Space Blaster, another kid's toy. On the side was a switch. He supposed the child who had received this for his birthday used it to make the gun ululate at different frequencies. What did it do now? Who gives a fuck, Gardner thought wearily. All this shit has become one big dumb bore. Bore or not, he put the gun in his belt and hopped back across the shed. At the door, he looked back at the old man. Thanks, guy. Faint, fainter, faintest, a dry rustle of leaves. Out of this, son? Yes, you and Peter both, you bet. He hopped outside and looked around. No one else had come yet. That was good. But his luck couldn't hold much longer. They were there. His mind touched theirs, like a couple waltzing with the care of strangers. He sensed them linked in a net, single consciousness. They were not hearing him, feeling him, whatever they did. Either using the transformer or just being in the shed had cut his mind off from theirs. But they'd soon know that, like Elvis, fat, flailing, but game and blindly bopping just the same, he had made a comeback. The sunshine was dazzling. The air was hot, full of a burning stink. Bobby's farmhouse was blazing like a heap of dry kindling in a fireplace. As he watched, half the roof fell in. Sparks, nearly colorless in the bright, declining day, rushed up to the sky in a flume. Dick, Newt, and the others had not observed much smoke because the fire was burning hot and colorless. Most of the smoke they'd seen had come from the burning vehicles in the dooryard. Guard stood for a moment on his good leg in the shed doorway, and then hopped for the whirligig. He made it about halfway and then sprawled full length in the dust. As he came down, he thought of the sonic space blaster in his belt. A kid's toy, no safety on a kid's toy. If the trigger was depressed, the essential gardener might suddenly be drastically reduced. The Tommyknocker weight loss plan. He took the toy gun out of his belt, handling it as if it were a live mine. He crawled the rest of the way to the whirligig on his hands and knees, then pulled himself up. 40 feet away, the other half of Bobby's roof collapsed. Hot sparks whirled toward the garden and the woods beyond. Guard turned toward the shed and thought again as hard as he could. Thank you, my friend. He thought there was an answer, some weary, faint answer. Gardner pointed the toy at the shed and pulled its trigger. A green ray, no thicker than a pencil lead, shot out of its muzzle. There was a sound like bacon frying in a skillet. For a moment the green beam splashed from the side of the shed like water from a hose, and then the boards burst into flame. More hot work, Gardner thought wearily. Smokey the Bear wouldn't dig me at all. He began to hop toward the back of the house, the sonic space blaster in his hand. Sweat and bloody tears ran down his face. Winston Churchill would have loved me, he thought, and began to laugh. He saw the tomcat, and then his jaws spread in another big yawn. It occurred to him that possibly Bobby had saved his life without even knowing it. In fact, it was more than possible. It was likely. The Valium could have protected him from the full force of the unimaginable power load that transformer carried. It might well have been the Valium which... Something inside the burning house, one of Bobby's gadgets, exploded with an artillery shell bang. Guard ducked his head instinctively. Half of the house seemed to suddenly lift off. The far side of it, fortunately, for Gardner. He looked up into the sky, and a second yawn turned into a large, stupid gape. There goes Bobby's Underwood. It flew up and up, a typewriter in the sky, whirling and turning. Guard hopped on. He reached the tomcat. The key was in the ignition. That was good. He'd had enough troubles with keys to last him the rest of his life. What little might remain. He pulled himself up onto the seat. Behind him, vehicles approached and turned into the dooryard. He didn't turn around to look. The tomcat was parked too close to the house. If he didn't get moving right now, he was going to bake like an apple. He turned on the key. The tomcat's motor made no sound, but that didn't bother him. It was vibrating faintly. Something else exploded inside the house. Sparks drifted down and prickled his skin. More vehicles turning into the yard. The minds of the arriving Tommyknockers were turned toward the shed, and they thought, "Baked apple, he's baked inside the shed, dead in the shed, right, yes." Good, let them think that. The new and improved tomcat wouldn't clue them in. It was as noisy as a ninja. And he had to go. The garden was already on fire. The giant sunflowers and huge corn stalks with their giant, inedible ears of corn blazing. But the path down through the middle of the garden was still passable. "Hey! Hey! Hey! He's behind the house! He's alive! He's still—" Gardner looked to his right, dismayed, and saw Nancy Voss roaring across the stony field which lay between Bobby's place and the stone wall at the edge of the herd property. The Voss woman was on a Yamaha trail bike. Her hair was tied in braids which flew out behind her. Her face was a harridan's glare, although she still looked like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, next to Sissy, Gard thought.
"Hey, back here, back here!"
"Oh, you bitch," Gardner thought, and raised the sonic space blaster. 23. 20 or 30 of them had entered the yard. Adley and Kyle were among them. So were Frank Spruce, the Goldens, Rosalie Scahan, and Pop Cooter. Newt and Dick were back by the road, keeping all in order. All of them turned toward,
"Here, back here, alive, the son of a bitch is still—"
Nancy Voss's screams. They all saw her charging across the field on the bike, looking like a jockey riding a hard-charging horse as the Yamaha's tough suspension system bounced her up and down. They all saw the green pencil beam shoot out from behind the burning house and envelop her. None of them saw the whirligig as it started to turn again. 24. One whole side of the shed was in flames. Part of the roof fell in. Sparks swirled in a fat spiral. One landed in a pile of greasy rags, and they bloomed with fire roses.
Deliverance, Ev Hillman thought. Last thing of all. Last thing.
The transformer began to pulse a brilliant green for the last time, for a moment or two rivaling the fire. 25. Dick Allison heard the creak of the whirligig. His mind was filled with a furious, feral cry of rage as he realized Gardner was still alive. All of it happened fast. Very fast. Nancy Voss was a flaming rag doll in the field to the right of Bobby's house. Her Yamaha ran on for 20 yards, struck a rock, and turned a back-over flip. Dick saw the burned hulks of Bobby's truck, Moss's truck, the Bozeman's olds, and then he saw the whirligig.
"Get away from that thing! Get away! Get—"
But there was no chance. Dick had fallen out of the net, and he couldn't get past the two thoughts it beat out like a primitive rock-and-roll backbeat. Still alive, behind the house, still alive, behind the house. More people were arriving. They were moving across the dooryard in a tidal flow, ignoring the blazing house, the blazing shed, the guttering, blackened vehicles.
"No, fucking damn fools, no, get down, get away!"
Mesmerized, Newt was staring at the inferno of the house, ignoring the whirligig, spinning faster and faster, and in that moment Dick could cheerfully have killed him. But he still needed him. And so he contented himself with pushing Newt rudely to the ground and falling on top of him. A moment later, the green parasol spread its delicate web over the yard again. 26. Gard heard the screams, a multitude of them this time, and shut them out as best he could. They didn't matter. Nothing mattered except getting to the last stop on the line. No sense trying to fly the Tomcat. He threw it into first gear and drove into Bobby's monstrous, useless, burning garden. There came a moment when he began to believe he wasn't going to make it. The fire had caught hold faster in the weeds and overgrown crops than he had believed possible. The heat was baking, tremendous. Soon his lungs would boil. He heard dull, thudding noises, like fat knots of pine exploding in a fireplace. Looked, saw pumpkins and gourds exploding like pine knots in a fireplace. The Tomcat's wheel was blistering his hands. Heat on his head. Gardner reached up. His hair was on fire. 27. The entire inside of the shed was ablaze now. In the middle of it, the transformer waxed and waned, a pulsating cat's eye in the middle of an inferno. Peter lay on his side, his legs stilled at last. Ev Hillman was looking at the transformer with exhausted concentration. The fluid encasing him was becoming very, very hot. That was all right. There was no pain, not in the physical sense. The insulation on the main cable connecting him to the transformer was now beginning to melt and fuse, but the connection still held. For the moment, in the burning shed, it held, and Ev Hillman thought, "The last thing. Give him a chance to get away. The last thing." "Last thing," the computer screen flashed. "Last thing, last thing, last thing." Then filled up with nines. 28. The destruction in Bobby Anderson's dooryard was incredible. Dick and Newt watched it, fascinated, almost unbelieving. As in the woods that day with the old man and the cop, Dick found himself wondering how things could possibly go so wrong. The two of them, they and all the others who hadn't arrived yet, were well outside the parasol's deadly perimeter. But still, Dick didn't get up. He wasn't sure he could. People were burning in the yard like dry scarecrows. Some ran, flapping and cawing and screeching with their voices and their minds. A few, a fortunate few, managed to back away in time. Frank Spruce walked slowly past where Dick and Newt lay. Half of his face burned away, so his jaws showed on that side in a half-grin. There were flash explosions as the weapons some of them carried fused and self-destructed. Dick's eyes met Newt's.
"Send them around. Flank him. Got to—"
"Yes, I see. But, oh, Christ, there must be 10 or 20 of us burning."
"Stop fucking whining."
Newt recoiled, lips bared in a toothless snarl. Dick ignored him. The mind net had fallen apart. Now he could make himself heard.
"Go around! Go around! Get him! Get the drunk! Go around!"
They began to move. Slowly at first, their faces dazed, and then, with quickening purpose. 29. The computer screen imploded. There was a coughing explosion, like a giant clearing a throat thick with phlegm, and thick green fluid poured from the shower cabinet in which Ev Hillman had been kept prisoner. It met the fire and produced a deadly green steam. Ev, mercifully dead at last, washed out like a fish from a burst aquarium. A moment later, Peter followed. Anne Anderson came last, her dead hands still hooked into claws. 30. The fire parasol died. Now there was no sound but the screams of the dying and Dick's insistent voice. The summer day was an inferno. Bobby's dooryard was a dirt pond filled with islands of fire. But the Tommyknockers always brought fire in the end, and they got used to it quickly. Newt joined his voice with Dick's. Kyle was dead, Adley badly burned. Nevertheless, Ad joined his own mortally wounded voice with theirs. "Get him before he can get to the ship. He's still alive. Get him before he can get to the ship. Before he can get to the ship." The Tommyknockers had taken a mauling. That 15 of them had been flash-fried in Bobby's yard was not very important. But Bobby was dead. Kyle was dead. Adley soon would be. The transformer had been destroyed just when the border closing had rendered their need for it critical. And Gardner was still alive. Incredibly, Gardner was still alive. Perhaps worst of all, the wind was freshening. 31.
"Get him! And get him quick!"
On the net. The Tommyknockers were on the net. They came across the fields, came toward the spreading fire.
"Quick!"
Dick Allison turned toward town, and the net turned with him like a radar dish. He sensed Hazel's dumb amazement at the turn of events. He, the net, brushed that aside.
"Whatever you got out that way, Hazel, send it at him."
Dick turned toward Newt.
"You didn't have to push me so effin' hard,"
Newt said sulkily, and wiped a drip of blood from his chin.
"Fuck you," Dick said deliberately. "Let's get that son of a whore."
32. The whirligig, dead now, had started a fire that was spreading out from Bobby's house in a shape which resembled a lady's fan. A fire fan. Bobby's house, now only black bones, shimmering in a red pillar of fire, was at its point of origination. The wings were spreading through the obscenely overgrown garden, and as the mutated plants burned, the fire glowed green. Passing between the flames was Jim Gardner, crowned with burning hair. His shirt was smoldering. One of the sleeves squirted smoke and then burst into flames. He slapped them out. He wanted to scream, but he seemed too tired, too woozy.
"I have been badly used," Gardner thought, "and it is no one's fault but my own."
He reached the far edge of the garden. The tomcat lurched and waddled down a mile slope and into the woods. The low, scrubby bushes on the sides of the trail were on fire, and low runners of flame were already spreading into Big Engine woods.
Guard cared little for them. The feeling that he was going to be microwaved was passing. He whacked repeatedly at his head. His hair smelled dreadful, like food fried by a child. Green fire sizzled over his right shoulder as the tomcat entered the woods. Guard flinched to the left and ducked. He looked back, and there was Hank Buck with his own zap gun. Hank had ridden a motorcycle out to the farm, had dumped it in the same field where Nancy Voss had come to ruin, had picked himself up and started to run. Gardner turned around, held the sonic space blaster out straight in his right hand, and gripped his right wrist with his left hand. He pulled the trigger. The pencil beam stabbed out, and more by good luck than any sort of shooting skill, he struck Hank high up on the left side of the chest. There was a sound of frying bacon. Green death splashed up onto Hank's face, and he fell over. Gardner turned forward again and saw the tomcat moving toward a large burning spruce at a complacent 5 miles an hour. He hauled on the wheel with both blistered hands, barely avoiding a head-on collision. One of the tomcat's pillow tires scraped the trunk of the tree, and for a moment Gardner found himself shoving away blazing, fragrant spruce boughs like a man fighting his way through burning curtains. The little tractor tilted sickeningly, tottered, then thumped back down again. Gardner pushed the throttle lever as far as it would go and hung on as the tomcat made its way up the path into the woods. 33. They came. The Tommyknockers came. They came along the widening wings of that fiery lady's fan, and Dick Allison began to feel a kind of furious desperation, because they weren't going to catch him. Gardner had been able to use the path. That had made all the difference. 3 minutes later, maybe even one, and Gardner really would have been cooked. Four of the Tommyknockers, Mrs. Eileen Crenshaw and the Reverend Gooringer among them, tried to follow him that way and were burned alive. Two of the gigantic flaming corn plants toppled onto the Crenshaw woman, who shrieked and let go of the dune buggy steering bar. The dune buggy promptly drove itself into the depths of the flaming garden. Its tires exploded like bombs. Bare seconds later, fire choked the whole path. Dick's frustration went deeper than the bone. The becoming had been thwarted and choked off before. Not often, but it had happened, but always as the result of some natural intervention, as a whole generation of mosquito larvae breeding in a quiet, stagnant pond may be killed by a stroke of lightning from a summer storm. But this was no thunderstorm, no natural happening. This was one man, a man they had all regarded with the kind of wary contempt reserved for a stupid dog which may bite. This was one man who had spent most of his time with Bobby in a drunken stupor. One man who had somehow tricked Bobby and killed her, and who refused to die no matter what they did. "We will not be stopped by one man," Dick thought frenziedly. "We will not!" But was there any real way to stop just that from happening? The fire front was now spreading too fast for them to catch him. Gardner had managed to shoot down the center of an alley of fire, but he would be the only one. Hank Buck had had a shot, but somehow the fucking son of a bitch had managed to shoot Hank dead. Dick was in a perfect ecstasy of fury. Newt sensed it and kept his distance. Dick was 20 pounds heavier and 10 years younger. But at the center of his rage was terror, like a cold curdle of rancid cream in the middle of a poisoned chocolate. The Tommyknockers, Bobby had told Gardner, were great sky travelers. This was true, but never, anywhere, had they met anyone quite like this one man who kept going, even with his shattered ankle, his great loss of blood, and his ingestion of a drug that should have rendered him unconscious 15 minutes ago, in spite of the great lot he had vomited up. Impossible, but happening. Somehow the fire that was supposed to keep Gardner from the ship had become Gardner's shield. Now there were only the automated monitors, the gadgets. "They'll get him," Dick whispered. He and Newt were standing on a knoll to the right of the house, like a pair of generals, watching people stream into the woods, but doing so on a pair of infuriatingly oblique angles. Dick's hands opened, snapped closed, opened, closed. Green blood beat in his neck. "They'll get him. They'll stop him. He's not going to get to the ship. He's not. He's not!" Newt Barringer kept prudently silent. 34. The smoke detector, very like a flying saucer itself, flickered silently through the woods, with the red sensor light on its underside pulsing erratically. Hazel MacCready was controlling this baby herself. She had caught Dick Allison's wave of anger, despair, and fear, and had determined to take care of Gardner herself, by remote control, as it were. First, she had put Pauline Googe, whom she felt most trustworthy, to work on one other matter, and then Hazel had gone down to her office, closed the door, and locked it. From the bottom drawer of her filing cabinet she brought out a ghetto blaster, a little smaller than the late Hank Buck's disposal unit. She put it on her desk, turned it on, took an earphone from the out-basket of her desk minder, and put the plug in her ear. Now she sat with her eyes closed, but she could see trees rush past on either side of the smoke detector as it whizzed through the woods about 6 feet above the ground. Gardner would have been forcibly reminded of the sequence in The Return of the Jedi, when the good guys chased the bad guys through a seemingly endless forest at brain-numbing speeds on what appeared to be air motorcycles. Hazel, however, had no time for metaphors, nor ever would, if they got out of this. Tommyknockers weren't much into metaphors, either. Part of her, the smoke detector part on the machine side of the cyborg interface she'd made, wanted to fulfill its original function and buzz, because the woods were full of smoke. It was similar to the feeling one has when a sneeze impends like a rain shower. The smoke detector banked easily from side to side, slaloming around trees, popping up over knolls, and then zooming back down them like the world's smallest crop duster. Hazel sat bent forward at her desk, earplug pushed firmly into her ear, concentrating fiercely. She was pushing the little smoke detector through the woods faster than was safe, but it had been at the Haven-Newport border, fully 5 miles from the ship. She had to get to Gardner, and time was short. The smoke detector flipped onto its side and missed a small pine tree by inches. A close call, that, but there he was. And there was the ship, throwing back its echoes of light, tattooing its dancing sun dapples on the trees. The smoke detector hovered motionless above the thick mat of fallen needles on the floor of the forest for a moment, and then it arrowed directly at Gardner. Hazel prepared to turn on the ultrasound attachment that would turn Gardner's bones to smashed fragments in his body. 35. "Hey, guard, on your left!" The voice was unbelievable. It was also unmistakable. It was Bobby Anderson's voice. The old, unimproved Bobby. But Gardner had no time to think about that. He looked left and saw something slashing out of the woods at him. It was tan. There was a red light flashing on its underside. That was all he had time to see. He brought the sonic space blaster up, wondering how he could ever in the world hope to hit that thing, and at the same moment, a wild, thin shriek like every mosquito in the world, whining in perfect harmony, filled his ears, his head, his body. Yes, it was inside him. Everything inside him was beginning to vibrate. Then it felt as if hands seized his wrist. First seized it, then turned it. He fired. Green fire shot across the daylight. The smoke detector exploded. Several jagged chunks of plastic flew near Gardner's head, barely missing him. 36. Hazel screamed and bolted upright in her old swivel chair. A tremendous backflow of energy surged through the earplug. She clawed at it and missed. The plug was in her left ear. From her right one came a sudden squirt of greenish, soupy liquid. It looked like radioactive oatmeal. For a moment, her brains continued to hose out of her head through her ear, and then the pressure became too great. The right side of her skull pushed open like a strange flower, and her brains hit her Courier and Ives wall calendar with a liquid smack. Hazel fell forward limply onto her desk, her hands outstretched, her glazing eyes staring unbelievingly at nothing. The ghetto blaster radio buzzed for a while and then stopped. 37.
Bobby?
Gardner thought, looking around wildly. Fuck you, old hoss, an amused voice returned. That's all the help you get. After all, I'm dead, remember?
I remember, Bobby.
One piece of advice.
Watch out for rabid vacuum cleaners. Then she was gone. If she had ever been there. From behind him came the rending, grinding crash of a tree falling over. The woods between here and the farm had begun to sound like a big, open-hearth fireplace. Now he could hear voices from behind him, both mental and shouted aloud. Tommyknocker voices. But Bobby was gone. You imagined it, guard. The part of you that wants Bobby, that needs Bobby, is trying to reinvent her, that's all. Yeah? And what about the hand? The hand over my hand. Did I make that up? I couldn't have hit that thing all by myself. Annie Oakley couldn't have hit that thing without help. But the voices, those in the air and those inside his head, were getting closer. So was the fire. Gardner drew in a throatful of smoke, put the Tomcat in gear again, and got going. There was no time for debate right now. Guard headed for the ship. 5 minutes later, he came out in the clearing. 38.
Hazel?
Newt cried in a kind of religious terror. Hazel? Hazel? Yes, Hazel! Dick Allison shouted back at him furiously, and could restrain himself no longer. He threw himself upon Newt. Stupid bastard!
Whore boy!
Newt spat back, and the two of them rolled about on the ground, green eyes glaring, grabbing for each other's throats. This was not at all logical under the circumstances, but any resemblance between the Tommyknockers and the likes of Mr. Spock was purely coincidental. Dick's hands found the wattled folds of Newt's throat and began to squeeze. His fingers punched through the flesh, and green blood bubbled up over Dick's fingers. He began to raise Newt up and slam him back down. Newt's struggles lessened, lessened, lessened. Dick choked him until he was quite dead. With that done, Dick discovered that he felt a little better. 39. Guard dismounted the Tomcat, staggered, lost his balance, fell down. At that same instant, a buzzing, snarling projectile blasted through the air where he had been a moment before. Gardner stared stupidly at the Electrolux vacuum cleaner, which had nearly torn his head off. It bulleted across the clearing like a torpedo, banked and came back at him. There was something on one end that distorted the air into a silvery ripple, something like a propeller. Gardner thought of that round, chewed hole in the bottom of the shed door, and all the spittle in his mouth dried up. Watch out for... It dive-bombed him, the cutter attachment whining and buzzing like the motor of a kid's gas-powered fighter plane. The little wheels, which were supposed to make the weary housewife's work easier, as she trundled her faithful vacuum cleaner along behind her from room to room, spun lazily in the air. The hole, where one was supposed to clip various attachment hoses, gaped like an open mouth. Gardner made as if to dive to the right, then held position a moment longer. If he jumped too soon, the vacuum cleaner would jog with him and chew through his guts as easily as it had chewed through the shed door when Bobby called it. He waited. Fainted left this time, then threw himself to the right at the last moment. He thudded painfully into the dirt. The bones in his shattered ankle ground together. Gardner screamed miserably. The Electrolux crashed. The propeller ate dirt. Then it bounced, like a plane, rising into the air again after touching down too hard on a runway. It whistled off toward the great canted dish of the ship, and then banked around for another run at Gardner. Now the cable it had used to run the buttons was emerging from the hose attachment hole. The cable whistled in the air, a dry, snake-like sound that Gardner could just hear under the rumble roar of the fire. The cable whickered, and for a moment Gardner was reminded of a Wild West rodeo his mother had taken him to once, in that rootin'-tootin' trail-drive town of Portland, Maine. There had been a cowboy in a tall white hat who had done rope tricks. In one of the tricks, he had floated a big lasso at ankle height, dancing in and out of its circle while playing My Gal Sal on a harmonica. The cable whirling out from the attachment hole looked like that rope. "Fucker'll cut your head off just as slick as shit through a goose if you let it, guard, old guard." The Electrolux whistled at him, shadow tracking beneath.
On his knees, Gardner held out the sonic space blaster and fired. The vacuum cleaner sheared off as he aimed, but Gardner winged it just the same. A chunk of chrome above a rear wheel blew off. The cable drew a wavering line through the dirt. "Get him. Yes, get him, before he can hurt the ship. Closer." The voices were closer. He had to end this. The vacuum cleaner skirted a tree and circled back. It tilted upward, climbed, then dropped in a kamikaze power dive, its chopping blade turning faster and faster. Gardner steadied himself by thinking of Ted the Power Man. "You want to take a look at this shit, Teddy boy," he thought crazily. "You'd go ape for it. Better living through electricity." He pulled the trigger on the toy gun, saw the green pencil beam splash off the vacuum cleaner's snout, and then shoved himself forward, digging with both feet, and never mind the shattered ankle. The Electrolux struck the ground beside the Tomcat and buried itself 3 feet deep in the dirt. Black smoke jetted from the protruding end in a tight, compact little cloud. It made a thick farting noise and died. Gardner got to his feet, holding on to the Tomcat for support, the sonic space blaster dangling from his right hand. The plastic barrel, he saw, was partially melted. It wasn't going to be any good much longer. The same was undoubtedly true of himself. The vacuum cleaner was dead. Dead and sticking out of the ground like a dud bomb. But there were plenty of other gadgets on their way. Some flying, some trundling enthusiastically through the woods on makeshift wheels. He couldn't wait around. What was it the old man had been thinking at the end? The last thing, and deliverance.
"Good word," Gardner said hoarsely. "Deliverance. Great word."
Also he realized the name of a novel. A novel by a poet, James Dickey. A novel about city men who had to get slugged, mugged, and buggered before discovering they were good old boys after all. But there was a line in that book, one of the men looking at one of the others and telling him calmly, "Machines are going to fail, Lewis." Gardner certainly hoped so. He hopped over to the lean-to, then pushed the button which started the sling's descent. He was going to have to go down the cable hand over hand. It was stupid, but that was Tommyknocker technology for you. The motor began to whine. The cable began to descend. Gardner hopped over to the cut and stared down. If he could actually work his way down there, he would be safe. Safe among the Tommyknocker dead. The motor stopped. He could faintly see the useless sling at the bottom. The voices were closer, the fire was closer, and he sensed a rogue's gallery of gadgets closing in. Didn't matter. He had shot the chutes, climbed the ladders, and somehow got to the finish line before the others. "Congratulations, Mr. Gardner. You've won a flying saucer. Do you want to quit, or go for the all-expenses-paid vacation in deep space?" Gardner croaked, tossing the half-melted toy gun aside. "Let's do it." That also had reverberations. He seized the cable and swung out over the cut. As he did, it came to him. Sure. Gary Gilmore. It was what Gary Gilmore said just before stepping in front of the firing squad in Utah. 40. He was halfway down when he realized the last of his physical strength had run out. If he didn't do something quick, he would fall. He began to descend more quickly, cursing their thoughtless decision to put the motor control so far from the trench. Hot, stinging sweat ran into his eyes. His muscles jumped and fluttered. His stomach was beginning to do long, lazy flips again. His hands slipped, held, slipped again. And suddenly the cable was running through his hands like hot butter. He squeezed it, screaming in pain as the friction built. A steel thread, which had popped up from one of the cable's steel pigtails, punched through his palm. "God!" Gardner screamed. "Oh, dear God!" He thudded neatly into the sling on his bad foot. Pain roared up his leg, through his stomach, through his neck. It seemed to rip off the top of his head. His knee buckled and struck the side of the ship. The kneecap popped like a bottle cap. Gardner felt himself graying out and fought it.
He saw the hatch. It was still open. The air exchanger still droning. His left leg was a frozen wall of pain. He looked down at it and saw it had become magically shorter than his right leg, and it looked, well, it looked croggled, like an old stogie that has been carried around too long in someone's pocket. "Christ, I'm falling apart," he whispered. And then, amazing himself, he laughed. It did have this to recommend it. It was a hell of a lot more interesting than just stepping off a breakwater with a hangover would have been. There was a high, sweet, buzzing sound from overhead. Something else had arrived. Gardner didn't wait to see what it was. Instead, he pushed himself into the hatch and began to crawl up the round corridor. The light from the walls glowed softly on the planes of his haggard face, and that light, white, not green, was kind. Someone seeing Gardner in that light might almost have believed he was not dying. Almost. 41.
Late last night and the night before, over the river and through the woods, Tommyknockers, Tommyknockers, knocking at the door, to Grandmother's house we go. They look so quiet, but they ain't quite dead. The horse knows a way to carry the sleigh. You get that Tommyknocker flu inside your head, over the frozen fields of snow. Doggerel chiming in his head, Gardner crawled up the corridor, pausing once to turn his head and vomit. The air in here was still pretty fucking rank. He thought a miner's canary would already be lying at the bottom of its cage, alive, but only by an inch or so. But the machinery guard, do you hear it? Do you hear how much louder it's gotten just since you came in? Yes, louder, more confident. Nor was it just the air exchangers. Deeper in the ship, other machinery was humming into life. The lights were brightening. The ship was feeding off whatever was left of him. Leaded. He reached the first interior hatchway. He looked back, frowned at the hatch giving on the trench. They would be arriving in the clearing very soon now, perhaps already had. They might try to follow him in. Judging by the awed reactions of his helpers, even hard-headed Freeman Moss hadn't been completely immune. He didn't think they would. But it wouldn't do to forget how desperate they were. He wanted to be sure the loonies were out of his life once and for all. God knew he hadn't much left. He didn't need those assholes fucking up what little there was. Fresh pain blossomed in his head, making his eyes water, tugging at his brain like a fish hook. Bad. But nothing compared to the pain in his ankle and leg. He was not surprised to see the main hatchway had irised closed. Could he open it again if he wanted to? He somehow doubted it. He was locked in now, locked in with the dead Tommyknockers. Dead? Are you sure they're dead? No. To the contrary, he was sure they were not. They had been lively enough to start it all up again. Lively enough to turn Haven into one weird munitions factory. Dead? Unfucking likely, Gardner croaked, and pulled himself through another hatchway and into the corridor beyond. Machinery pounded and hummed in the guts of the ship. When he touched the glowing, curved wall, he could feel the vibration. Dead? Oh, no. You're crawling around inside the oldest haunted house in the universe, guard, old guard. He thought he heard a noise and turned around quickly, heart speeding up, saliva glands squirting bitter juice into his mouth. Nothing there, of course. Except there was. I had a perfectly good reason to raise this fuss. I met the Tommyknockers, and they were us. Help me, God, Gardner said. He flicked his stinking hair out of his eyes. Over him was the spidery thin ladder with its wide-spaced rungs, each with that deep, disquieting dip in the middle. That ladder would rotate to the vertical when, if, the ship ever heeled over to the proper horizontal flight position. There's a smell in here now. Air exchangers are not a smell.
It's the smell of death, I think. Long death. And insanity. Please help me, God. Just a little help, okay? Just a few breaks for the kid is all I'm asking for. Okay? Still conversing with God, Gardner pressed onward. Shortly, he reached the control room and lowered himself into it. 42. The Tommyknockers stood at the edge of the clearing, looking at Dick. More arrived each minute. They arrived, then just stopped, like simple computer devices whose few programmed operations had all been performed. They stood looking from the canted plane of the ship to Dick, back to the ship, to Dick again. They were like a crowd of sleepwalkers at a tennis match. Dick could sense the others, who had gone back to the village to run the border defenses, also simply waiting, looking through the eyes of those who were actually here. Behind them, growing closer, gaining strength, came the fire. Already the clearing had begun to fill with tendrils of smoke. A few people coughed, but no one moved. Dick looked back at them, puzzled. What exactly did they want from him? Then he understood. He was the last of the shed people. The rest of them were gone, and directly or indirectly the death of each had been Gardner's fault. It was really inexplicable, and more than a little frightening. Dick became more and more convinced that nothing quite like this had happened in all of the Tommyknockers' long, long experience. They're looking at me because I'm the last. I'm supposed to tell them what to do next. But there was nothing they could do. There had been a race, and Gardner should have lost, but somehow he hadn't, and now there was nothing to do but wait. Watch and wait and hope that the ship would kill him somehow, before he could do anything, before a large hand suddenly reached into Dick Allison's head and squeezed the meat of his brain. His hands flew up to his temples. The fingers splayed into stiff galvanic spider shapes. He tried to scream, but was unable. Below him, in the clearing, he was vaguely aware that people were falling to their knees in ranks, like pilgrims witnessing a miracle or a divine visitation. The ship had begun to vibrate. The sound filled the air with a thick, subaural hum. Dick was aware of this, and then as his eyes blew out of his head like half-congealed chunks of moldy jelly, he knew no more. Then or ever. 43. Little help, God. We got a deal? He sat in the middle of the canted hexagonal room, his twisted, broken leg stuck out in front of him. Croggled. That word wouldn't go away. His leg had been croggled. Near where the thick master cable came out of the gasket in the floor. Little help for the kid. I know, I'm not much. Shot my wife. Good fucking deal. Shot my best friend. Another good fucking deal. A new and improved good fucking deal, you might say, but please, God, I need an assist right now. That was no exaggeration, either. He needed more than just a little. The thick cable split off into 8 thinner ones, each ending not in an earplug, but in a set of headphones. If he had been playing Russian roulette back in Bobby's shed, this was like sticking his head into a cannon and asking someone to pull the lanyard. But it had to be done. He picked up one set of phones, noticing again how the centers bulged inward, and then looked toward the tangle of brown, sear bodies in the far corner of the room. Tommyknockers? Hey, nonny nonny, nonsense name or not, it was still too good for them. Cavemen from space. That was all they had been. Long claws, operating machinery they made but didn't even try to understand. Toes like the spurs on fighting cocks. This thing was a malignant tumor that needed quick removal. Please, God, let my little idea be right. Could he tap all of them? That was really the $64,000 question, wasn't it? If the Becoming was a closed system, something on the skin of the ship simply biodegrading into the atmosphere, the answer was probably no. But Gardner had come to think, or perhaps only to hope, that it was more. That it was an open system, where the ship fed the humans, causing them to become, and the humans fed the ship so it could, what, come again, of course. Could one use the word resurrection? Sorry, no. Too noble. If he was right, this was a kind of freak show parthenogenesis, whose proper place was under tawdry carnival lights and in cheap tabloids, not in undying myths or religious creeds. An open system. A slave system. Quite literally, a go-fuck-yourself system. Please, God. Little help right now. Gardner donned the headphones. It happened instantaneously. No sensation of pain this time. Only a great white radiance. The lights in the control room flashed up to full bright. One of the walls turned into a window again, showing the smoky sky and the fringe of trees. And then another of the room's eight walls went transparent. Another. Another. In a space of seconds, guards seemed to be sitting in an open space with the sky above him and the trench with its silvery netting on either side. The ship seemed to have disappeared. He had a 360-degree view. Motors kicked in, one by one, and cycled up to full running pitch. A bell was ringing somewhere. Huge, thudding relays kicked over one by one, making the metal deck shiver under him. The feeling of power was incredible. He felt as though the Mississippi was running through his head at flood level. He sensed it was killing him, but that was okay. "I've tapped them all," Gardner thought faintly. "Oh, God. Thank you, God. I've tapped them all. It worked." The ship began to tremble, to vibrate. The vibration became spasms of racking shudders. The time had come. Baring the last few of his teeth, Gardner prepared to reach down and grasp his own bootstraps. 44. He had tapped all of them. But it was Dick Allison, because of his greater evolution, and Hazel's 40 or so border watchers back in town who bore the brunt of the ship's powering up process. These latter were all tied together neatly in one unified web, and the ship simply reached out for it. They slumped over, blood trickling from their eyes and noses, and died as the ship sucked their brains up. The ship drew from the Tommyknockers in the woods as well, and several of the older ones died. Most, however, felt only an excruciating pain in their heads as they either knelt or lay, half-fainting, around the perimeter of the clearing. A few understood that the fire was very close now. As the wind freshened, that burning lady's fan spread, and spread. Smoke ran across the clearing in thick, grayish-white clouds. The fire crackled and thundered. 45. Now, Gardner thought. He felt something in his mind slip, and catch firmly. It was like a gear shift. There was pain, but it was bearable. They're feeling most of the pain, he thought faintly. The sides of the trench appeared to move, at first just a little, then a little more. There was a grinding, squealing sound. Gardner bore down, his brow locked in a tremendous frown, his eyes squeezed into slits. The silvery mesh began to slip past, slowly but steadily. Not that it was moving at all, of course. It was the ship that was moving. That grinding noise was the sound of it pulling itself free of the bedrock which had held it so long. Going up, he thought incoherently. Ladies' lingerie, hosiery, notions, and be sure to visit our pet department. It was gaining speed, the trench walls passing more quickly to either side. The sky widened out ahead. It was a dull gunmetal color. Sparks twisted by like formations of tiny burning birds. He brimmed with exultation. Gardner thought of looking out of a subway window as the train left the station, slowly at first, then beginning to speed up. How the tile walls seemed to unroll backward, like the strip of paper in a player piano. How you could read the ads as they passed from left to right. Annie, the chorus line. These times demand the times. Touch the velvet. Then into the darkness, where there was only movement and a vague sensation of black walls rushing past. A klaxon went off three times, nearly deafening him, making him shriek. Fresh blood spattered into his lap. The ship shuddered and rumbled and squealed and dragged itself out of the earth's crypt. It rose into thickening bands of smoke and hazy sunlight, its polished flank coming out of the trench, out and up, a moving metal wall. One standing right next to this insane sight might have been tempted to believe that the earth was creating a stainless steel mountain or injecting a titanium wall into the air. As the arc of the edge grew broader and broader, it reached the edges of the trench Bobby and Gardner had dug steadily wider, ripping at the earth with their smart, stupid tools, like half-wits trying to perform a cesarean section. Up and out and up. Rocks squealed. The earth moaned. Dust and the smoke of friction fumed from the trench. Up close, the illusion of an emerging mountain or wall held, but even from such a short distance away as the edge of the clearing, the thing's circular shape was revealed. The titanic shape of the saucer, now emerging from the earth like a great engine. It was silent, but the clearing was filled with the coarse thunder of breaking rock. Up and out it came, cutting the trench wider and wider, its shadow gradually covering the whole clearing and burning woods. Its leading edge, the one Bobby had stumbled over, sheared off the top of the tallest spruce in the forest and sent it tumbling and crashing to the ground. And still the ship birthed itself from the womb which had held it so long, continued until it covered the whole sky and was reborn. Then it stopped cutting the trench wider. A moment later there was actually a gap between the edges of the trench and the edge of the emerging ship. Its center had at last been reached and passed. The ship rumbled out of the smoky trench, emerging into the smoky sunshine, and at last the squealing, rumbling sounds ceased, and there was daylight between the ground and the ship. It was out. It rose on a slanted, canted angle, and then came to the horizontal, crushing trees with its unknown, unknowable weight, bursting their trunks open. Sap sprayed the air with thin amber veils. It moved with slow, ponderous elegance through the burning day, cutting a swath along the tops of the trees like a clipper trimming a hedge. Then it hovered, as if waiting for something. 46. Now the floor below Gardner was also transparent. He seemed to be sitting in thin air, looking down at the billowing reefs of smoke coming from the edge of the woods and filling the air. The ship was fully alive now, but he was fading fast. His hands crept up to the earphones. "Scotty," he thought, "give me warp speed. We're blowing this disco." He bore down hard inside his mind, and this time the pain was thick and fibrous and sickening. "Meltdown," he thought dimly. "This is what meltdown feels like." There was a sensation of tremendous speed. A hand knocked him sprawling to the deck. Although there was no sensation of multi-G force, the Tommyknockers had apparently found a way to beat that. The ship didn't tilt. It simply rose straight up into the air. Instead of blotting out the whole sky, it blotted out only three quarters, then half. It grew indistinct in the smoke, its hard-edged metal-alloy reality growing fuzzy, and thus dreamy. Then it was gone in the smoke, leaving only the dazed, drained Tommyknockers to try to find their feet before the fire could overtake them. It left the Tommyknockers and the clearing, the lean-to, and the trench, like a black socket from which some poisonous fang had been drawn. 47. Guard lay on the floor of the control room staring up. As he watched, the smoky, chromed look of the sky disappeared. It became blue again, the brightest, clearest blue he had ever seen. "Gorgeous," he tried to say, but no word came out, not even a croak. He swallowed blood and coughed, his eyes never leaving that brilliant sky. Its blue deepened to indigo, then to purple. "Please don't let it stop now. Please." Purple to black. And now in that blackness he saw the first hard chips of stars. The klaxon blared again. He felt fresh pain as the ship drew from him, and there was a sensation of increasing speed as it slipped into a higher gear. "Where are we going?" Gardner thought incoherently. And then the blackness overtook him, as the ship fled up and out, escaping the envelope of the Earth's atmosphere as easily as it had escaped the ground which had held it for so long. "Where are we?" Up and up, out and out, the ship rose, and Jim Gardner, born in Portland, Maine, went with it. He drifted down through black levels of unconsciousness, and shortly before the final vomiting began, a vomiting of which he was never even aware, he had a dream. A dream so real that he smiled as he lay in the middle of blackness, surrounded by space, and with the earth below him like a giant blue-gray croaker marble. He had gotten through it, somehow gotten through it. Patricia McCardle had tried to break him, but she had never quite been able to do it. Now he was back in Haven, and there was Bobby coming down the porch steps and across the dooryard to meet him, and Peter was barking and wagging his tail, and Guard grabbed Bobby and hugged her, because it was good to be with your friends, good to be where you belonged, good to have some safe haven to come to. Lying on the transparent floor of the control room, already better than 70,000 miles out in space, Jim Gardner lay in a widening pool of his own blood and smiled. Epilogue 1. Most of them died in the fire. Not all. 100 or more never reached the clearing at all before the ship pulled itself out of the ground and disappeared into the sky. Some, like Elt Barker, who had gone flying off his motorcycle, did not reach it because they had been wounded or killed on the way. Fortunes of war. Others, like Ashley Ruval and old Miss Timms, who was the town librarian on Tuesdays and Thursdays, were simply too late or too slow. Nor were all those who did reach the clearing killed. The ship had gone into the sky, and the awful draining power which had seized them dwindled away to nothing before the fire reached the clearing, although by then sparks were drifting down and many of the smaller trees at the eastern edge were blazing. Some of them managed to stumble and limp further into the woods ahead of that spreading fiery fan. Of course, going straight west was no good to these few. Rosalie Scahan was among them, as were Frank Spruce and Rudy Barfield, brother of the late and mostly unlamented Pitts, because eventually they would run out of breathable air, in spite of the prevailing winds. So it was necessary to first go west, and then turn either south or north in an effort to buttonhook around the fire front, a desperation play where the penalty for failure was not losing the ball, but being roasted to cinders in Big Engine Woods. A few, not all, but a few, actually did make it. Most, however, died in the clearing where Bobby Anderson and Jim Gardner had worked so long and hard, died within feet of that empty socket where something had been buried and then pulled. They had been used roughly by a power which was much greater than the early tentative state of their becoming could cope with. The ship had reached out to the net of their minds, seized it, and used it to obey the controller's weak but unmistakable command, which had been expressed as warp speed to the ship's organic cybernetic circuits. The words warp speed were not in the ship's vocabulary, but the concept was clear. The living lay on the ground, most unconscious, some deeply dazed. A few sat up, holding their heads and moaning, oblivious of the sparks drifting down around them. Some, mindful of the danger coming from the east, tried to get up and fell back. One of those who did not fall back was Chip McCausland, who lived on Dugout Road with his common-law wife and about 10 kids. 2 months and 1 million years ago, Bobby Anderson had gone to Chip for more egg cartons to hold her expanding collection of batteries. Chip shambled halfway across the clearing like an old drunk and fell into the empty trench. He tumbled, shrieking, all the way to the bottom, where he died of a broken neck and a shattered skull. Others who understood the danger of the fire and who could possibly have gotten away elected not to do so. The becoming was at an end. It had ended with the departure of the ship. The purpose of their lives had been cancelled. So they only sat and waited for the fire to take care of what remained of them. 2. By nightfall there were less than 200 people left alive in Haven. Most of the township's heavily wooded western half had burned or was burning flat. The wind grew stronger yet. The air began to change, and the remaining Tommyknockers, gasping and whey-faced, gathered in Hazel McCready's yard. Phil Golden and Bryant Brown got the big air exchanger going. The survivors gathered around it as homesteaders might once have gathered around a stove on a bitter night. Their tortured breathing gradually eased. Bryant looked over at Phil. "Weather for tomorrow? Clear skies, diminishing winds." Marie was standing nearby, and Bryant saw her relax. "Good. That's good." And so it was, for the time being. But the winds were not going to remain calm for the rest of their lives. And with the ship gone, there was only this gadget and 24 truck batteries between them and eventual strangulation. "How long?" Bryant asked, and no one answered. There was only the flat shine of their frightened, inhuman eyes in the fire-shot night. 3. The following morning, there were 20 less. During the night, John Leandro's story had broken worldwide, with all the force of a hammerfall. State and defense departments denied everything, but dozens of people had taken photographs as the ship rose. These photographs were persuasive, and no one could stop the flood of leaks from such informed sources as frightened residents of the surrounding towns and the first arriving National Guardsmen. The Haven border barriers held, at least for the time being. The fire front had advanced into Newport, where the flames were finally being brought under control. Several Tommyknockers blew their brains out in the night. Polly Andrews swallowed Drano. Phil Golden awoke to discover that Queenie, his wife of 20 years, had jumped into Hazel McCready's dry well. That day there were only 4 suicides, but the nights were worse. By the time the army finally broke into Haven, like inept burglars into a strong safe, later that week, there were less than 80 Tommyknockers left. Justin Hurd shot a fat army sergeant with a kid's Daisy air rifle that squirted green fire. The fat sergeant exploded. A scared E-4 in the APC, just then roaring past Cooter's Market, turned the .50 caliber he was sitting behind on Justin Hurd, who was standing in front of the hardware store, wearing only a yellowing pair of Hanes underpants and his orange work shoes.
"Fix them woodchucks!" Justin was screaming. "Fix them all! You're fucking A! You're—"
Then he was hit by some 20 .50 caliber slugs. Justin nearly exploded, too. The E-4 puked into his gas mask and nearly choked on the stuff before someone could get a fresh one over his face.
"Someone get that pop gun!" a major shouted through an electric bullhorn.
His mask muffled his words, but did not destroy them.
"Get it, but be careful. Pick it up by the barrel. I repeat, be extremely careful. Don't point it at anyone."
Pointing it at someone, guard would have said, always comes later. 4. More than a dozen were shot down on the first day of the invasion by scared, trigger-happy soldiers, kids, most of them, who pursued the Tommyknockers from house to house. After a while, some of the invaders' fear began to rub off. By afternoon, they were actually having fun. They were like men driving rabbits through wheat. 2 dozen more were killed before the Army doctors and Pentagon brain trusters realized that the air outside of Haven was lethal to these freak show mutations who had once been American taxpayers. The fact that the invaders could not breathe the air inside Haven would have seemed to have made the converse self-evident, but in all the excitement, no one was really thinking very well. Guard wouldn't have found this very surprising. Now there were only 40 or so. Most were insane. Those who weren't wouldn't talk. A makeshift stockade was built in the area which passed for a town square in Haven Village, just below and to the right of the towerless town hall. They were kept there for another week, and during that period, another 14 died. The changed air was analyzed. The machine which manufactured it was carefully studied. The failing batteries were replaced. As Bobby had suggested, it didn't take the brain trusters long to understand the mechanics of the device, and the underlying principles were already being studied at MIT, Caltech, Bell Labs, and the shop in Virginia by scientists who were nearly vomiting with excitement. The remaining 26 Tommyknockers, looking like the weary, pox-rattled remnants of the final Apache tribe in existence, were flown in the controlled environment cargo bay of a C-140 Starlifter to a government installation in Virginia. This installation, which had once been burned to the ground by a child, was the shop. There they were studied, and there they died, one by one by one. The last survivor was Alice Kimball, the schoolteacher who was a lesbian, a fact Becca Paulson had learned from Jesus one hot day in July. She died on October 31st, Halloween. 5. At about the same time Queenie Golden was standing on the edge of Hazel's dry well and preparing to jump in, a nurse stepped into Hilly Brown's room to check on the boy, who had shown some faint signs of returning consciousness over the last couple of days. She looked at the bed and frowned. She couldn't be seeing what she was seeing. It was an illusion of some kind, a double shadow thrown onto the wall by the light from the corridor. She flipped the wall switch and took a step closer. Her mouth dropped open. It hadn't been an illusion. There were 2 shadows on the wall because there were 2 boys in the bed. They slept with their arms wrapped around each other. What? She took another step, her hand going unconsciously to the crucifix she wore around her neck. One of them, of course, was Hilly Brown, his face thin and wasted, his arms seemingly no thicker than sticks, his skin nearly as white as his hospital Johnny. She didn't know the other boy, who was very young. He was wearing blue shorts and a T-shirt which read, "They call me Dr. Love." His feet were black with dirt, and something about that dirt seemed unnatural to her. "What?" she whispered again, and the younger boy stirred and wrapped his arms more tightly around Hilly's neck. His cheek rested against Hilly's shoulder, and she saw, with something like terror, that the boys looked very much alike. She decided she had to tell Dr. Greenleaf about this, right now. She turned to leave, heart beating fast, one hand still clutching at her crucifix, and saw something that was quite impossible. "What?" she whispered for the third and last time. Her eyes were very wide. More of that strange black dirt. On the floor. Tracks on the floor, leading to the bed. The little boy had crossed to the bed and gotten in. The 2 boys' facial resemblance suggested that this was Hilly's missing and long since presumed dead, brother. The tracks didn't come from the hall. They started in the middle of the floor, as if the little boy had come from nowhere. The nurse bolted from the room, screaming for Dr. Greenleaf. 6. Hilly Brown opened his eyes.
"David? Shut up, Hilly. I'm sleeping."
Hilly smiled. Not sure where he was, not sure when he was, sure only that many things had been wrong. Just what those things had been no longer mattered, because everything was okay now. David was here, warm and solid against him.
"Me too," Hilly said. "We got to trade G.I. Joe's tomorrow."
"Why?"
"I don't know, but we got to. I promise."
"When?"
"I don't know."
"As long as I get Crystal Ball," David said, settling himself more firmly into the crook of Hilly's arm.
"Well, okay."
Silence. There was a dim commotion at the nurse's station down the hall, but here there was silence and the sweet warmth of boys.
"Hilly?"
"What?" Hilly muttered.
"It was cold where I was."
"Was it?"
"Yes."
"Better now?"
"Better." "I love you, Hilly."
"I love you too, David."
"I'm sorry."
"For what?"
"I don't know."
"Oh."
David's hand groped for the blanket, found it, and pulled it up. 93 million miles from the sun, and 100 parsecs from the axis pole of the galaxy, Hilly and David Brown slept in each other's arms. August 19th, 1982. May 19th, 1987.
This concludes the reading of The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Copyright 1987 by Stephen King, Tabitha King, and Arthur B. Green, Trustee. This book was read by Edward Herman. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with NAL Signet, a member of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated, and was produced in 2010 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright.